Welcome everybody to Low Score episode 33.
Hey, big episode 33.
That's what I wanted to hear. I am Bobby. I am sitting in a chair over here. What are you over there?
I'm Jay, and I'm over here in this big comfy chair. And we're gonna be going on. We've got a big packed show.
I like to imagine that people place us in their minds as to where we're sitting. Like maybe you're like a left brain and I'm a right brain. We're sitting, we're having a chat.
Yeah, that's the thing. You know, which we should do. We should mix it so that like you come out of the left channel and I come out of the right channel. So if somebody was sitting with their headphones on or in stereo, it would be like, you know, we were talking across the table at them.
That would be awful.
That would be really awful.
It's like we're sitting at a bar yelling at each other.
Yeah, and so they would just be like, do you want me to fucking move? Do you guys just want to sit next? What's happening here?
Like, no, it's cool. It's cool. You know, you're part of the conversation. Like, no, you're not. Just fuck it.
We should also remark that we are recording early in the morning on a Saturday.
Yeah.
And I would like to say thank you for being accommodating. We were supposed to do this 2 days ago, and I totally forgot.
Yeah, that's okay. My girlfriend got this morning to go see New Moon at 10 a.m.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Paying those matinee prices, which is good.
You know what I did yesterday? That's awful.
What's that?
I watched the Twilight movie.
How? I will be totally honest. Curiosity is starting to get the better of me. And I'm like, I really want to know in not a douchey way, like, what the fuck is up with this movie? Because even like Carrie, who loves it, she'll say straight up, like, that's not a very good movie. She's seen it four times.
Yeah.
She's like, yeah, it's not very good. I don't think this new one will be good. She's still like hella going to see it.
Right.
Like this weekend.
Isn't that so weird? Like,
I don't understand.
We would never be fans of something that's just going to come out and be awful, right? Like,
no, because to me it's like to me it's like, okay, I really like Star Wars, all right, which is like a same like big pop culture thing. But I don't unequivocally like Star Wars. I'll be like, yeah, episode 1, 2, and 3, they're fucking awful. I've read Star Wars books that are junk, mm-hmm. You know.
So the movie is okay. That's what I can give it. The things in the movie that I'm interested in, like the story parts of the movie that I'm interested in, the book parts, I guess, are not covered enough. And there's too much like emo laying around. Oh my God, we're so in love.
Yeah.
Also, like there's a really intense scene where the two of them are like talking for like really the first time and getting into like the depths of stuff. And there's like 5 songs playing concurrently in the score. So it's like 3 tracks in the score, like 3 distinct tracks in the score, plus like just another song, like a soundtrack song playing at the same time. I'm like, I can't hear you over all of the music. I felt like I was in a club. Like, what, could you speak up? Because you want to do what with? Oh, it was like the movie itself is bad. Like, it is not a well done movie.
Yeah, well, of course. Well, yeah, I mean, obviously it's real low budget, and the special effects are like obviously bad. Like when you look at trailers and stuff,
yeah.
At least for the first one. One thing that I don't understand about it is, as a, I guess, fan of vampire things like Buffy and True Blood, the Twilight vampires, they don't seem evil. Like, why would you not? Like, what's the negative of being a vampire in the Twilight universe? You just seems like you're invincible and you can't die, but nothing hurts you.
Right. So here's what I figured out. So and this is from asking Megs too, because isn't it like
stakes don't work? Sunlight doesn't hurt them. That just makes them sparkly.
Right.
Silver doesn't hurt them.
Right.
Garlic doesn't hurt. Like what?
Like okay. Oh, yeah. So the way to get rid of a vampire is to rip their flesh apart and like into like rip their body into pieces and then burn them. So that's kind of cool.
You can't just burn them.
No, you have to like
you have to put them up first.
You have to make sure that they are really, really dead first, and then burn all the pieces. Apparently, like that's according to the books.
Okay.
So with like each vampire, like there's a lot of the vampires apparently in the little vampire universe live on their own. They hunt humans and they are killers and stuff. It is just like this little like weird core of vampires that live in this small town that have banded together that are very unusual.
Right, they like they eat like animals and stuff.
Right, they eat animals. Like they live together. They form like bonds and relationships. So like the antagonist vampires are definitely more violent and stuff.
Okay,
but yeah, like the fact that it just ignores so much of like the vampire lore that exists bothers me.
Yeah, it seems. I mean, every vampire thing has their own little tweaks and stuff
on
it, and
that's understandable. Like. You know, your Let the Right One In vampire is different than your Castlevania vampire. It's just
right, totally. So I'm definitely curious and all that.
Unfortunately, the way that it seems that the books are written, like, it just doesn't get into the lore that much. It's all about the romance.
Right.
So I would like to read like the side books, like all the books explaining the universe, the stuff that I don't normally care to read, like in the Lord of the Rings. I would read all that.
Oh, yeah. All that except for,
like, yeah. I would, what's the fifth Lord of the Rings book, like after the Hobbit and,
oh, the Simulacrum?
No, that's Baudrillard.
Oh shit.
Hang on.
What? All right. While Bobby's doing this, I'm looking this up.
I got it. Let's see if we can. I get it first. I feel like such a
internet versus
book.
Fuck.
The Silmarillion.
That's what it is. I was close with Simulacrum.
Yes, you were. Simulacrum is a world of simulation.
Yeah, never mind. I just thought of a word that sounded like the word that I was half remembering.
That's pretty good. I'm impressed that you know Simulacrum.
Hey, there you go.
But this isn't a Simulacrum podcast.
It's not, nor is it a Twilight podcast, nor is it a fantasy world in literature podcast from the last 100 years. It's a podcast about video games.
Yay, it certainly is. And, God, fuck, we have so much to talk about today. We said last time was a packed show.
I know.
Like, last time was just carry-on luggage. Like, now we have to check it.
We have to check our bags. And we should waste more time by talking about Twilight some more.
Yeah.
All right, so
we're going to kick it off with leftover lists from last time. Because we recorded an odd hour of the day, Friday mid-afternoon, a number of the lists trickled in by the evening. So we have a couple things we want to update. Solosi, this is for, we should remind people that this is for the five best games based off of other media property. So movies, books, comics, television, etc.
Whatever.
Solosi writes in, Batman Arkham Asylum.
Yeah, great game on my list.
The Simpsons arcade game from the arcade.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, that game is real fun.
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Turtles in Time for Super Nintendo.
I don't know.
People's nostalgia for that game gets in their way. The fact that there's nothing wrong with that game.
No,
it's just, you know, that's it.
I think the Simpsons arcade game is much better because one of the things that holds up about the Simpsons arcade game is it's so fucking weird and crazy.
That
fighting Mr. Smithers like in a balloon. That's way, like, there's something so weird and bizarre
because
that makes that game more enjoyable.
Because it came out so early in the Simpsons property, it just hadn't like figured out like what the world is. So just you're right, it doesn't make any sense. Like,
it doesn't make sense.
Have you ever seen Marge vacuuming? Ever?
No, never. Let alone hitting people with a vacuum.
Just doesn't make any sense.
Or Lisa jump roping, for that matter. I guess they're like, she's a girl. Yeah, just give her that.
Number two, Star Wars, Knights of the Old Republic.
Yep.
He likes it on the 360, which is interesting.
That did not come out on the 360.
I played it for points.
Yeah.
Number one, DuckTales.
Yeah, good. Obviously, those Capcom Disney games rock.
Friend of the show, Leon, writes in, Tiny Toons, Buster Busts Loose.
For the SNES, that's a great game. I forgot about that game.
That is a pretty fun game. I still like the Tiny Toons on Super Nintendo or regular Nintendo better.
I agree.
Tiny Toons Adventures, but...
Yeah.
Now, we have some qualms here because these next two games, he listed Aladdin and The Lion King, but said both Super Nintendo and Genesis.
Yeah, which, as we discussed last time, are distinct games. And those games, especially Aladdin, showed up on a number of lists, but people specified
which
Genesis version or SNES version.
So, Leon, you got some soul searching to do, and you got to figure out whether your loyalties to Nintendo reign or whether the better Lion King Genesis game is more important.
Ooh, tough battle.
Ouch. Star Wars Knights of the Republic?
Yep, good.
And GoldenEye?
Yeah.
Hard to argue.
GoldenEye's great.
Friend of the show, good friend of the show, Jimmy wrote in.
Sometimes host of the show.
Yeah. Shadow Complex, since it was based on an Orson Scott Card novel, although only loosely.
Yeah, I don't know that Empire novel. I don't know how close it I mean, I know it's based on it, but I'm not sure exactly like what threads tie. I think the game's a prequel to the book.
He writes in, and by all accounts, the book was wretched. We should
note. Yeah, that's what I've heard.
Star Trek Voyager or Elite Force, which is a PC shooter from 2000. Have you played this, Jay?
Yeah, it's really good. Well, it is surprisingly good.
Okay.
It's a totally solid, like shooter in the vein of like Dark Horse. Like, it's probably pretty dated at this point, but since Star Trek games are in general so awful. I'm like, yeah, that's a legitimately fun game. I mean, I think it got pretty good reviews too. If you go back and check it out.
Well, that's so weird to see this in, as a first-person shooter. I'm looking at screenshots right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a legit, like you have a like gun slash phaser rifle, and you shoot like Dark Forces, but Star Trek Voyager. It's weird.
I'm down with that.
Me too, man.
Number three on his list, Surf's Up. He comments, I am honestly not sure if I'm being funny here or not. No, Jay, you recently played Surf's Up?
I did. So I borrowed this game a while ago from him. And I played a little bit of it, kind of forgot about it. And so once we got this list, I was like, yeah, I'm going to check that out, maybe get some easy points, whatever. I'm honestly not sure if he's being funny or not either. It's, like I said, I came in playing it for the points. And it's the only game I've ever sat down to play specifically with points in mind that, like, wasn't a chore, was a really pleasant, fun ride, like, all through it. Here's the thing. This game is really – it's, like, really shallow and really short and not very complex.
Mm-hmm.
But everything it sets out to do is well executed. It's like the people who made this game knew they were working under the same, like, budget and time – and I'm sure, like, short staff constraints that all the other, like, movie tie-in games were. But they kept the scope of the game short and execute it really well. It's basically, like, a Tony Hawk ripoff, like, on the water. I guess, like, one of those, like surfboard games or whatever, where you there's, like, literally a big wave always next to you, and you're riding it up like it's a half pipe or something.
TNC Surf Designs.
Yeah, exactly. doing really, I mean, super-duper simple tricks. And if you do enough tricks in a row, you like get a super meter, and then you can turn the super on and get like crazy bonuses doing points in the air. And all of a sudden, there's like while you're going down, there's obstacles and stuff in the water. You've got to you can like kind of grind on stuff through little paths, and there's stuff to collect, and there's things you can go under. What are these little paths you can go under and to get points and complete objectives and stuff. It's real simple, and it's a lot of fun.
That doesn't sound all that bad. I expected the WALL-E game to be decent because, okay, it stars a robot. Well, that's easy enough. So, yeah. Like, you just put the robot in the world and make him do, like, Ratchet and Clank type stuff. But cool. that game was garbage. It's not good. Which is too bad because it stars a robot.
I think Surf's Up is a really good example of how you should do a licensed game. Like, I don't know if it belongs in a category with, like, you know, Knights of the Old Republic and GoldenEye and Shadow Complex and stuff. Like, it's not great. But it sets out to not do much, and it really well executes that limited scope. And I got 810 points for basically doing like, you know, 3 or 4 hours worth of work. Awesome. So I would check it out.
Second on his list, Michael Jackson's Moonwalker. Obviously,
I can't believe did nobody mention this game?
No, know why? Because it's bad. It's not a good game. It's
the arcade one's a little better than the Genesis one. It doesn't really hold up.
It's not a good game.
Novelty factor, right?
It's not a good game. And I have to take some issue with number five here. Barbie Horse Adventures.
This, you know.
You know why I say that?
Why is that?
Because he doesn't specify which one. There are multiple Barbie Horse Adventures games. That is a series. There's Wild Horse Rescue for the PS2, Riding Camp for the DS. You can play Mystery Ride for the PC. Like, what? Come on, Jimmy.
Obvious disqualification here.
Yeah.
That's a pretty amateur mistake.
If you're going to give us an answer like that, I want you to specify. Yeah. Kevin commented, based on last time's question, around his Pool of Radiance submission as an answer.
Yes.
We were not sure whether or not...
Right, I kind of took issue with it because I was like, hold on. You can't, like, just a game that uses the D&D conventions doesn't count. But then we're like, hold on, maybe it's based on, like, an actual like quest book or a novel or something, because then it would certainly count. We just didn't know. And he addresses the question.
So Kevin wrote to me and said, my gut instinct failed and Jay was sort of right. I thought that Pool of Radiance, the game, was based on a novel, but it turns out that the novel was a novelization of the game. But, according to Wikipedia, Pool of Radiance was based on a published adventure model called Ruins of Adventure. So whether or not it is an adaptation is contestable. I said that the subject matter is probably too broad in general. He linked me to the Wikipedia article. He says, here's the thing. The module, locations, and basic plot are in the adventure, but it looks like the game was released before the adventure was published as a for sale public thing, which creates a web of intrigue.
I think that the same question kind of states, like, if the game is in fact based on the adventure model, I think it totally counts on the list. But if the game, if like the, since they came, it seems like they came out pretty close. I mean, if the game came before the adventure model, you would think that, like, well, of course not. Like, the adventure model is based on the game. But if it came out, like,
between the publishing of the game and the finishing of the game.
It's basically, when did they, like, who came up with the story? Yeah. Like, which department? So, I don't know.
So, if you know anybody who worked at Forgotten Realms,
please let us know so we can clear up this Pool of Radiance question, this lingering asterisk on Kevin's list.
We're going to do things a little differently today, too. We're going to switch up the order of some of the stuff that we've been talking about.
Indeed.
Now, we, and by we, I should say I, because I made the mistake of not doing this. I forgot to post on the blog and tweet out that we were creating our lists this week. Because we're recording early in the morning, I just slipped my mind.
Yes.
Please forgive me. So what we're going to do is tell you our lists for this topic, and then we're going to take your submissions next time.
That sounds good. We'll do it in reverse. Okay. There'll be a lot of listen happening. So what is our list? You came up with the list this week, and I like it because it's very different than the kind of list we've been doing.
So this week's the list. 5 characters you'd like to hang out with for a day. That's just, you know, 5 people that either adventures you want to go on, so you want to, like, live in their game world and do their game things, or maybe you want to, like, have them trail you in your world. Maybe they go to school with you, like, if they're walking on campus around MARTA and stuff. So, I'm really excited about this because it's the first one we've done that's not just games.
Right. Yeah. It really made me think and kind of, I had trouble coming up with this list. Like I said, I'm pretty happy with the 5 that I came up with, but, usually I come up with a bunch and have to pare it down. This one, I really had to think about it.
I have to put a qualification that 2 of my answers I'll have to leave to Jay to judge, and I'm sure that I can come up with one to replace it. I'll start with my first one, which is contestable.
Okay.
I would like to hang out with Pikmin for a day. Just like a bunch of them, just like a little group of them. Is that okay as one? Because, like, you'll never just have, like, a Pikmin, because a Pikmin is worthless.
I think that's a good choice. I think that's fair.
So, yeah, I would just sit on my couch and just be like, shoot my little flashlight over there, and they'd run and get my soda and bring it over. And I would just walk around the neighborhood with them, like, doing little swirls around me, just like being Olimar. That's all I want.
That's pretty good.
I just pick them up, start tossing them across the room. My dog would go fetch them. It'd be awesome.
How would you make more Pikmin? Would you have, like, an onion that you could go and bring stuff to?
I don't think so. I think in this situation,
just have a fixed amount.
It has to be a fixed amount. They won't.
Do you have a color preference, or would you want?
I want a mix. Yellow. I want a mix. Yeah. And we're only talking about Pikmin from Pikmin 1, so it's just red, yellow, blue.
I agree.
None of this white and purple.
I think that counts as a choice because not only would one Pikmin be useless, there's no, like, distinct character personality of a singular Pikmin.
Right.
It seems like they exist and their personality shines in big groups. Okay. So I think your choice is fair.
Thank you. So what's your first?
Okay, so my list, 3 of these are from role-playing games. I just think naturally they have really big personalities. So I'm going to start off with maybe my favorite role-playing game character, and that would be Barrett Wallace from Final Fantasy VII.
Nice.
Who is a total badass. Not only is he a badass and a total raw dog with a gun arm, my favorite thing about Barrett Wallace is in the fiction of Final Fantasy VII, he continually is like, listen, I don't really understand what is going on around me right now in the world. What are you doing?
I'm doing my Barrett hands.
You got your big square on one hand and your gun arm on the other. Yeah. He's like, listen, I do not understand anything that is happening in the game right now, but I know that I like you guys and you seem to be real fired up about this Sephiroth dude. So I will shoot things in the name of you guys. And I'm like, that is a good friend.
Yeah,
he just has a good attitude and a big heart, man. I like Barrett.
He also has some very good wisdom, which is there ain't no getting off this train we on.
That's true, man. Once you get on that train, and see, it's a metaphor because when he says that, they are literally on a train. But it's also like a one way path towards their goal. But I love Barrett. He's funny. He's kind of a grounded character in a world of over-the-top, you know, anime-style Final Fantasy characters, which is, you know, a great cast in and of itself. But gotta love me some Barrett. That's my first choice.
Very nice. Yeah.
Who's your number 2?
My number two is Brucey from Grand Theft Auto 4.
Okay, well, we have a duplicate.
I figured we would, because Brucey knows how to party. Brucey is the character that walks up to Nico and is like, we need to get on a helicopter and just go flying around, and it's going to be awesome. He's totally roided out. He probably does coke all day long. He loves chicks and blowing things up and get on helicopters and boats and cars. Like, this man knows how to party. I want to just trail around Liberty City and see him do his thing for a day.
Yeah, I mean, my only qualification is I would like to hang out with him for a day. I would not really like to be his friend.
No.
I would not like him showing up at 3 a.m., roided out.
Hey, Jay, let's go play pool.
Being like, I just stole this car. I got 8 guns in my back seat. I got 3 girls tied up in the trunk. And we are about to party. You know, I don't want that happening.
No.
But I would like to see what he does for a day and go and hang out with another awesome fella. So, Brucey, good choice.
I guess I'll go next since we both did the same one.
Sure.
My number three, and this is the other one where I was like, I'm not sure if this is going to count, but I think it does.
Okay.
It would be the Shaker Brothers from Chrono Cross. That's Salt and Pepper.
Oh, man.
They are the, like, doofusy guards who follow General Viper around Arcadia Guards, and like they're just like idiots. Like they must have the funniest, zaniest misadventures. And
you Rosencrantz and Guildenstern.
Yeah, basically, like you could make an entire game about like what they did.
Again, I will allow it.
Okay.
Yeah, because their enjoyment is their dialogue back and forth between each other. I think that's a good choice.
And I don't want to be involved in any of it. I just want to like tail them for a day. So as opposed to really hanging out and like being involved in the conversation, just watching.
Just watching. I just want to see. Taking notes, having a good time.
Exactly.
I like it. I like that choice.
All right. What's your number three?
Well, I went for the Chrono World, and I picked Robo from Chrono Trigger.
I can understand this.
Because he's the man. I just, again, kind of like Barrett. He's just a robot with a big heart who wants to go help people out. And I feel like he would be really helpful for a day if I was like, hey, would you hang out for millennia and like, take care of this forest, he would be like, okay.
You know how much database programming you could get done if you could go back in time and have him do it for you?
Oh, my God. It would be the best. I could learn so much, man. Like, well, I wouldn't need to be studying or anything. He could just help me out. He just seems like he's up for anything. He's just like, hey, thanks for fixing me. Let's go hang out. Let's go get stuff done. I liked him because unlike kind of everybody else who have big personalities, Robo just kind of seemed like he'd be helpful. He would just be a good dude to hang out with. That's why I pick Robo.
I think that is a very good choice. All right, so my number four is from an RPG as well, and that would be Balthier from Final Fantasy XII.
All right, I thought about this. That's a great choice.
He's the pirate dude,
the Han Solo of the Final Fantasy world,
and like. Sky pirates are generally just cool because pirates are cool, totally. And you put them in the sky, and that makes them extra cool.
It makes them better.
Number two, he's got an awesome voice. The guy who did that voice acting is brilliant. So his like faux, almost British voice, which is not quite. It's like upper crust, like 1920s America movie voice more than anything.
Yes, that is a very good descriptor.
And they built the Final Fantasy XII Revenant Wings DS game around Van, Fran, and Balthier, like that. Those are your characters for that game. Yeah. So their adventures hold up for a sequel, or quote sequel, like a continuing adventures of type game. So you know that they do cool stuff all day long, and I get to ride around in an airship.
Yeah, and that's really what is there better in life than hanging on an airship? That's a great choice. What a great, you know, again another good cast of characters.
Yeah,
no, Balthier.
Number four.
My final RPG choice, and I don't know, I'm not sure how familiar you are with this guy, is this, again, I guess is a duo, but it's Minsk from Baldur's Gate series.
Okay, I do not know this one.
I'm specifically from Baldur's Gate 2, which is where I'm most familiar with him. He is like a ranger cool dude. He's like part of your party, like one of the minor characters, who is put in – I mean, he has his own kind of stories and stuff, but he's mainly put in for comic relief because he hangs out with his hamster Boo, who he believes is a miniature giant space hamster.
What?
Which is why he is his ally. Yeah. So in this like medieval fantasy world, he's hanging out with his tiny hamster. And like as the game goes on, like you can kind of decide through the story, like if you believe Minsk or not. I have a lot of trouble saying the name, but yeah, the idea of that character is so crazy. Like, in, again, this like heavy Dungeons and Dragons, like, you know, high fantasy, dark role playing story. This right. total goofball character, who again, very loyal, very very lighthearted. You know, he'd be a good like drinking pal because he would tell you stories that you would not know if they were made up or not, or like where they're coming from. yeah, I think he would be fascinating you to just sit and listen to. I'd just be like, just tell me things. So yeah, man. Minsk.
Oh, good choice.
Minsk. All
right, my final character. And I had trouble deciding on this one because I knew it was going to be someone from Vice City.
Right. Okay.
Now, there are a lot of great choices. Like, I could do, like, Ricardo Diaz or Cortez. Like, I could either hang out on a boat or, like, crazy rich people. I was like, well, no, let's go for the core characters. It's either going to be Tommy Vercetti or Lance Vance.
Right.
And I decided, you know what? Lance Vance. He's the character I want to hang out with the day. Nice. This is the guy voiced by Philip Michael Thomas. So, A, it's kind of like hanging out with him for Miami Vice. Secondly, Lance Vance is an annoying character. He's always like pestering Tommy. He's always got to get his way. He's always screwing things up. And I think it would be more fun to hang out with him as opposed to Tommy Vercetti, who's just like, you know, a get stuff done kind of guy, no nonsense. Lance Vance likes the high life. He likes to drive around in the fancy cars and pretend he's somebody he's not. That sounds like the kind of day that I want to live.
Gotcha. I like that choice. You're a big fan of Vice City. My final choice, I just wanted to go a little off the rocker, and again, it's only for a day. I was like, who would be a good drinking buddy? And on that line, I picked Conker from Conker's Bad Fur Day.
Ooh.
Who is an alcoholic squirrel who is just, again, another raw dude who would just, I feel like if you wanted to get shit-faced and just bitch about stuff, he would be a good guy to do it with.
He would get in a bar fight with you.
Yeah.
Just for fun.
Absolutely.
He'd just be like, he'd punch some dude in the shoulder and just point at you. And then.
Oh, yeah, man.
I like that choice.
That's my choice.
He
again.
Would, any sort of animal that spends its day cursing, I'm in.
Right.
Consider me in. All right, so what we want you to do, now that we've given our lists, is for you to write in with your the list.
Exactly.
So send your five characters you'd like to hang out with for a day to lowscorepodcast.blogspot.com or go up to the website lowscorepodcast. No, I said that backward.
Yeah, you have to email lowscorepodcast@gmail.com.
At
or go to lowscorepodcast.blogspot.com and post in the comments.
Yes, that's what you need to do. And tell us, and we'll read them next week on the air at the beginning. We might have another list, so you might be submitting two lists for the same podcast.
Right.
We will see. All right.
Terrific, but everybody loves lists, so that's okay.
People do like lists. So, Jay, what have you been playing?
Well, we've been playing, well, I guess first game I would say is Forza 3, which I probably played the most of since the last time we talked.
Which is interesting because we inverted there, because I have not been playing a lot of Forza 3. I only picked it up yesterday again. So
yeah, I kind of got bit by the bug and just like wanted new cars, and I'm leveling up, and I'm in the middle of my R3 series.
Wow.
The year 4. Yeah, I don't have much more to say about that game. It continues to be super fun, and you should go buy it.
So the only thing I have to add to the game, I am in my A Championship series now. So the thing I have to add to the game is that I started doing the sprints, which is when we discussed on the podcast before, you get put on a specific part of a long track and you just race from point A to point B. And this is the one place that I've found where the rewind button doesn't necessarily come in handy.
Right.
Because usually the end of these tracks is like a really like sharp turn and something, and you cross like a little finish line as opposed to like a straightaway, as most of the tracks have. But if you were too close to the finish line and you screw up, you can't press the rewind button.
Yes, that has happened to me, and I've had to totally restart the race. It sucks.
And because it's usually such a close race because they're matching you with cars that are your skill level.
Right.
So it's not like a bunch of crappy cars and stuff that you could just get past. You don't have a whole lot of time to get past them. You are constantly battling for first place during these. So yeah, like I had times when I just like took that last corner just a little too fast, smash into the wall, restart the race. It's the first time I've had to actually I mean, not the first time, but the first like real time I've had to restart races because of that.
Yeah, it's definitely changed that way. I've even had where like I want to rewind so early in the race, like it has not built up any rewind time.
Especially so if I take like a better car into a crappy race where people don't speed up too fast, I will smash into somebody and turn around because I accelerate way too fast.
Right. That happens.
That's a pain in the ass. Shit.
That's it's a huge pain in the ass.
I'm like, just let me be in first. I'm the fastest car. Let me be in first and just get out in front of everybody. Why make me battle? Why put me in
first
place?
Those are almost a bummer because they're almost not fun because it's such an extra. Like, you're like, of course I'm going to win. Like, these cars are D cars and I'm in an S.
Yeah. And you could technically hire a driver who would take your winnings, but the races are so short.
Yeah, it's not worth it. They're like, worth it. I mean, they're literally 4 or 5 minutes.
Yeah. So that's Forza 3.
That's Forza.
I've been playing hell of Borderlands.
I've been playing a little Borderlands.
I've been playing a lot of Borderlands.
What level are you at this point?
I just hit level 30.
Oh, wow. I'm 26. And I don't know about you, but I'm at a point where like I do not level up very often. Like I played for like 90 minutes this morning, and I leveled up once.
What were you doing this morning?
Just a couple quests. But
whereabouts?
I was in Skaggs Gully.
What? Why are you back there?
I had some mission I had to go and get a bunch of stuff. The quest I was doing, I had to get like 24 bottles of beer.
Okay, yes.
For Crazy Eddie.
Yeah, Crazy Ed.
And a lot of the places I just haven't discovered yet because I like to kind of stay where I am and do side quests and stuff. So I had to do an inadvertent amount of exploring before I could like get to where my quests were. So I think I did one quest in the time, but I shot a bunch of dudes. And
now here's an interesting question: the collecting the bottle of beer stuff. Where did you do that?
I forget. I'm really bad with the names of places. It was one where I had to like shoot dudes and the bottles came out of them.
Right. So here's the interesting thing: when I did that quest, I ended up going to the docks, which is like one of the, I can't remember, it's like Treacher's Landing or something.
That's where I was. Yeah.
Okay, so
that's
exactly where I was. You did go there. I wasn't sure if I had just gone there and was shooting dudes and it happened to fall out or what. But if you go all the way to the end of one of the docks, I don't know if you did this, but there's like a singular dock on the right-hand side, and there's a little party boat at the end of it, and it's like covered with bright lights and stuff, and if you jump on it, you get an achievement that says, "I'm on a boat."
I didn't do that.
I think it might be 20 points for being on a boat.
That's hilarious.
And the description says, "Bet you never thought you'd be on a boat."
That's pretty fantastic. Yeah. Have you gotten the one, "My brother is an Italian plumber"?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You have to kill an enemy by jumping on its head.
That's pretty good.
Which is hard. But I've had a lot of fun with that game. So there is definitely a lull in between, I wouldn't say 20 and 30, but I would say probably like 23 and 28 or 22 and 28 as far as the levels are concerned. Mm-hmm. But the last two big things that I did by myself, there's one place called Crom's Canyon, which there's like a dude at the top of this canyon with a big like machine gun, Gatling gun, rocket launcher thing like firing down at you. And you're kind of zigzagging back and forth up the canyon across platforms and, you know, staircases and bridges and stuff, like battling individual dudes there trying to get to the top, and you're like hiding behind stuff so we can't shoot you. One of the more interesting scenarios in the game, like I haven't seen anything that made me feel Halo-y before, and this has a Halo feel as far as the scenario is concerned. Secondly, I ended up in Old Haven.
Yes, which you've mentioned is super exciting.
Yes, Old Haven is the coolest part of the game for sure. Like, you're battling new people. it's not the normal like raiders and badasses and psychos and stuff that you've been battling. It is a whole new set of enemies, and it's just awesome. And the points come, or not the points, but the experience points come really quickly.
Because that's good. That's really what powerful. I'm looking forward to. Yeah.
And then yesterday I actually started up a new character, a siren, who's the chick that does phase walk.
Yeah.
And phase walk, I figured out what it is because I had no idea before. Like, I thought you just slow down time, but when you enter phase walk, it slows everything down, but it creates a burst of energy. So if you stand in the middle of a group of enemies, you create a burst of energy. You move around them. When you go out of it, you create another burst of energy, which damages them, and then you shoot dudes.
That's pretty great.
But I created this character so that I could play with previous co-host, good friend of the show, Campbell, yesterday.
Yay!
Who picked it up? And is interested in playing.
Was he also playing a new character? Or
yes,
Okay, so you're both starting out.
I gave him the option. I said, I have this level 30 character that I can bring in, and we can fucking do some quests, and you can get some experience real fast.
Yeah, but he couldn't really play.
Right. You can tag along.
You just get mad experience. Right, which is definitely fun in its own right. But
yeah, he said, no, let's play your level 7 character. And it was difficult, because the first time I played with you and Jimmy, and Jimmy was level 20-something.
Yeah, and we were both in the teens or whatever. We might even been in the single digits.
I was still in the single digits. I had not even done level 5.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I was higher than you, but not a whole lot. I was like 10 maybe.
So it's cool because I got to do all these quests the last time. Like Jimmy just like ran and killed somebody, and I was like, oh, I got experience. I didn't get to see that. So yeah, that was fun. But I've just really been addicted to this game. Like every night before bed, I'm playing for like 2 hours.
That's great. Sometimes it holds up so well.
Sometimes just wandering around, sometimes actually doing quests.
It's a fun place to explore. I mean, it seems pretty desolate kind of at first glance, but there's a lot of little outposts, and they do a good job of making each area have a really distinct like character and feel and all that.
Yeah. One thing I wish that they did is that the fast travel in the game is based on location names.
Yeah.
So it's like, here's a mill of nowhere in the Rust Commons East. I'm like, well, I don't
know where that is. I wish there was like a map that came up. Yeah.
And it'd also be nice to have a map that shows you how each of the sections link to each other, because it'll give you like a world map for the area you're in. But there's no way of saying what does that exit connect to without me going there.
Right. Exactly. But, yeah, it's definitely very frustrating.
You played a bit of the Rock Band and the Beatles Rock Band?
I did. I want to talk about that too. This week, Sgt. Pepper came out, the like rest of the album, which I bought and played through a couple of times. I went and played through the whole... There's no like setting to do it, but I just went and played through a whole album in order. It's really fun. Though it seems like both of the album packs are better in single player mode or in like get a bunch of Beatles fans to play it, because when you download the rest of the album, you're like, I see why you left these songs out of the game. They are great songs, but they do not... not only are they generally not like the more well-known Beatles songs... they are songs that don't work as well in Rock Band. Because, I was excited to get, When I'm 64, because it was like, everybody knows that song. That's a fun song. Again, not a great Rock Band song.
Nothing to it. It's very slow. It's
very slow, very simple. And every song's kind of like that. It seems like there's really fun parts within the song, but they're not as geared towards a, party four-player element. So just kind of know that going in. I mean, this one was actually a pretty decent value. It was I think it's $13.50 for 8 songs.
And so, 8 distinct songs too, no?
None of those bullshit 1 minute Abbey Road songs and no songs mushed together or anything. 8 actual songs.
That sounds more reasonable than the Abbey Road one, because I'm still debating the Abbey Road DLC. I love that album, but it just it seems a ripoff.
Yeah, I would say particularly we played through a couple weeks ago the whole medley, which I would say the same thing about, is really fun if you want to hear those songs and listen to it, not as a Rock Band exercise. I would really recommend you can buy the 3 tracks solo. That's pretty worth it. I can't remember Maxwell Silverhammer. That's really fun, and I can't remember the other 2 songs that are actual songs from that pack, but.
So I had a huge problem with the advertising for the Sgt. Pepper's DLC, because they put out this trailer, and it's like, here are songs from Sgt. Pepper's.
And it's everything from Sgt. Pepper's.
Yeah, it's everything. I'm like, well, I already have that song. And I had a hard time distinguishing what were going to be the new songs.
Right.
I love that album, but I don't know the track list off the top of my head.
No, of course not. And at least it kind of says in that trailer, it's in little parentheses, it's on disc. Available in the new track pack, but it's a mess up because the first 4 songs on the album I think you have, so when it does it in album order, you're just like, oh dude, yes, I would love to play that song. It's like you can.
And none of the websites that I was reading actually listed what the songs are. I thank Jay for being a journalist and going out there and getting the list.
Yeah, it took 2 seconds. It's like, I don't know, I agree. And even go into the Xbox Marketplace, when you buy it, it's hilarious. It says, this track pack contains all of the songs from Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, except, and then it lists all the songs on the disc. You're like, that is exactly the opposite of what I need. What a pain in the ass.
I don't know why people are such bad video game reporters.
I don't know. But yeah, it's fun. Your mileage may vary. But it's certainly a fair deal, I think.
I think, like, even to be able to sing A Day in the Life, like, that's worth it.
Yeah, that's obviously the highlight. That's fun in Rock Band. It's nice and long. It's such a good song.
And for the benefit of Mr. Kite, like, that is a wacky song that I want to play.
Totally fun, yep.
But I need a lot of people for that one so that we can all be very strange and weird.
Mm-hmm. Wear costumes. Good harmonies, too. Mm. Good visuals. This one, unlike Abbey Road, you actually download new assets. There's new, a few new backgrounds and a couple new outfits and stuff, as well as recycled stuff.
Interesting.
So, yeah, it's fun. Hmm. I mean, they definitely reuse some stuff, like a lot of the assets from the actual Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band / With a Little Help from My Friends.
Right.
Like those, like, kind of carnival-y outfits and backgrounds they'll use. But there's also new stuff.
Say, in the past, though, we had speculated how big these things were and how much you could download based on what assets were already included in the game. So I wonder why Abbey Road did not need any new assets, but Sgt. Pepper does. Did.
Yeah, I don't know. Hmm. Beats me, but yeah, it's they're real. I mean, both sets. That's the one thing. It's like they do not seem skimped. Like, they all have new dreamscapes and backgrounds and stuff like that. And also, like, when you play A Day in Life, especially if you play it on guitar, like, that last note holds for like 45 seconds.
Oh God,
it goes like dong, and there's like weird trippy like stars and stuff on the screen, which is definitely a unique experience. You're like, is this ever going to end? What's happening here?
I hope that you don't miss that, because that would be a boring 45 seconds.
It'd be really boring. Yeah.
You're just like, ah. And of course, like, when you're playing with a lot of people and you're like on the guitar, so you're like, you're the last note. It's like, and you miss it. And then everyone just like looks at you, yeah, and you're like,
oh.
I'm sorry, everybody. Dude. We all failed.
You also, I find myself intuitively wanting to go like, wow, 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 because you got a big log, but it doesn't work in Beatles Rock Band. No dice. So those are the games.
So we're taking, I think, yeah, we have time for both of these questions.
Yeah, let's do it.
So Campbell wrote to me, and he said, I was wondering if maybe in your next podcast you could discuss something that I have to do for a media studies project, University of Virginia, by the end of the semester. My class is called War and the Media, and my group has decided to take on the medium of video games to present on. The topic isn't any more specific than that, but if you wanted to talk about war's representations in games with Jay, and maybe tie it into some sort of Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2 discussion, since that's topical now, that would be great. If not, whatevs. Maybe you don't even have to really plan a discussion, but rather could just devote your list of the top 5 games that represent war realistically. Clearly we did not do that, but
no.
We're going to do a free-form discussion.
Yeah, I really like this question. You know, I think that, you know, I talked before when I played Call of Duty 4 for the first time. It is weird to play a game in a setting like that where it's a little bit more ambiguous. Like, it's not like when I'm shooting zombies or aliens, like, of course. Or even if you're playing a World War II game, you're like, yeah, fuck the Germans. Like, they're evil and they did the Holocaust. When you're playing a game in like a made up war where you like, you kind of feel like, I want to know the whole history behind this. Like, they're probably bad, but like, or dude, like the soldiers, like, what's happening here? Like, it didn't make me not want to play Call of Duty 4 or be like, you know, this game sucks, but it was a little odd. It was just like, I don't know. And I think that's really what games do. I mean, obviously you can, you know, watch umpteen films or any kind of, you know, fiction, like examining the war experience, but something about putting you behind the gun and like making you perform the fiction, I think gives you a unique experience.
So in, you know, the representations, especially of World War II games, as Jay said, there was a clear enemy, clearly, you know, for all intents and purposes, in the right. Like, the right. Holocaust is bad, and killing other people is really bad. And
it was certainly, for the Europeans, it was a defensive war. It was like Germany is trying to conquer right. Europe, and then who knows what. It's like, you know, if you're France or Britain or Russia, you're like, dude, we got to do something about these guys. I mean, you know, despite the obvious reason, like, you want to help out the people who have been captured, you're like, I got to protect my land. But when you've got something like, yeah, like in the Middle East, where it's like we are the aggressors, like, going over for whatever reason, even if you think like those reasons are just, and even if the game presents them as just, it's still a little bit more dicey when you're like, ah, I don't know.
Now, something we wrote about in the upcoming book, which I should mention, by the way, our book, first manuscript, was sent off to the publisher to look at on Thursday. So,
you should clarify our, because I did not have anything to do with this book.
Oh, I'm sorry. The book that I've been working on with my professor Ian Bogost and friend Simon Ferrari, not our Jay and I. We did not write a book. We will write a book eventually, just you wait.
Definitely, yeah, just wait.
Just not this one. But in one of our sections, it's called Documentary. And it is exploring the idea of the video game as a documentary potential, or having potential for documentary. So we talked about the game 6 Days in Fallujah. Jay, do you remember this game being?
Absolutely, yeah, big controversy. Right. That it still hasn't been published, right?
No, it hasn't. And the publisher pulled out from it, saying that, you know, we can't do this. It was supposed to be Konami, I believe.
Yep.
But 6 Days in Fallujah was supposed to be a game about the Battle of Fallujah, so it's very specific, modern event, and it was supposed to represent, to some extent, war realistically. The idea was going to be, well, let us tell the tale of the Battle of Fallujah in a not necessarily like a glorified war kind of way. But you know, there are a lot of issues, and people aren't willing to handle a lot of this stuff. Number one, people don't take video games in general seriously, so they don't think that it could be a serious medium for documentary.
Right. Or they see the violence and they're like, violence is bad. Like, right. Done. And they don't, you know, think that there could be anything else beyond that.
You know, it would be, there's concerns that, well, you know, if the satisfaction that we get out of playing a first-person shooter is the elation of shooting dudes in the face, right? Like, being able to line up a cursor visually with the target and blasting away at it. Like,
yeah, I don't think it's necessarily as gruff as, like, I like to kill dudes. It's more like, I mean, like all games, aim. There's a puzzle. Yeah, there's an objective. Like, there is a challenge you are presented with, and there is a satisfaction from executing that challenge, particularly if it's difficult. Like, if you're, you know, there's overwhelming numbers or you make a difficult shot. I think that's where the elation comes from.
Yeah, exactly. It's this mechanical representation of performing an act on the screen. So it is, like I said, lining up a cursor with a head. Like, it's not because that is a person. It is because it is interesting to,
gotcha,
you know,
definitely,
be able to manipulate your movement, your cursor that way, and your body around. So yeah, the concern that any sort of video game that is based on war is fun, because war is not fun. War is hell.
No, it's terrible. Yeah.
And the question is, you know, I think one possible way to go with this is ask, what do war games do that are documentary like? And if you say documentary-like, it could be either your typical, History Channel type documentary. It could be documentarian instinct, like something like Saving Private Ryan, or it could even be the kind of war films that you would have seen in World War II, where you go to a movie and beforehand they play a reel, which is like our boys overseas.
Right.
You know, there's all these different angles that you could come at it from. So a possible area of discussion for y'all could be, what are these video games doing that relate to the way war has been presented in other forms of documentary? And you could also do a comparison that's, how does the topic change, how does the presentation change, and how do the objectives change as you move from different wars? So like we say, there's World War II, clear answer. And then there is you know, the modern wars, not so clear answer. And there's like weird things in between, like we talked about a number of times in this Kids Race as an example, the Medal of Honor Rising Sun, in which you're playing like as dudes shooting at the Japanese, except that game was really successful, or generally successful, in Japan.
Right.
Where they would be taking on the role of the other players and shooting at themselves. And sometimes I think that's the type of game that we need. We need something where you get to take both sides, and you could have two stories that are interweaving so that one side isn't glorified, and perhaps have an unresolved ending. Maybe, you know,
I think I think it'd be something really interesting for the Modern War series to discuss. A game like that that switched you between like the British and the American soldiers who kind of had like parallel stories, like not like thematically, but like they were going on at the same time and like kind of eventually merged up and stuff or crisscrossed. Yeah, to have something like that, you know, even where you like played one character and then like as the other character, like they end up killing them and then like kind of seeing what that happened. I think that'd be a really interesting way to explore, because you know it's like games are not the best at exploring like the like tough life of a soldier, mm-hmm. you know, like the hardships or like how hard it must be like back on the home front or something, because like you need that objective like context to make it an enjoyable like game experience.
I like this idea of the two characters coming together, because it would be really cool to say like, here's this American dude, and like he's kind of an asshole, but he's an American, so we forgive him. And then right. have this like really sympathetic character on the other side, and then right. at some point have them come together, and you have to make the decision which one of these characters kills the other.
Totally.
Like, do you side with the sympathetic character, or do you side with the American because he's American, and what he's doing obviously must be just?
And I think it would be neat. I think you couldn't cheapen it. I think like that should be the end of the game, because otherwise you could just be like, well, I want to like see like the rest of the game from this guy's perspective, or I want to see the rest of the game from this guy's perspective. I think it should be like, no, like that's it. Like you come to this crossroads and you like make a choice.
Yeah.
That should not be I think that it should be designed so like that's the motivation, rather than just more gameplay or something. That, yeah. Like to make the choice not mechanical, but make it purely emotional.
I like that a lot.
Yeah.
Another critique of the 6 Days in Fallujah game was that, you know, when they tried to describe it and they wanted to say, well, this is a game that represents the horrors of war, they called it a survival horror game, which is just a bad PR move, right?
It's just a bad PR. Yeah, you're like, that means I'm shooting zombies and dogs are jumping out of the windows at me. That does not mean.
Right. Like, people don't recognize that as like a genre trope, meaning like the setup of the game and the way that events are depicted, like that is very specific.
Yeah. Even, I mean, like obviously that evokes Resident Evil and Silent Hill and stuff, but even just saying horror
monsters,
people think monsters, people think, you know, Scream and Freddy Krueger and it's zombies. They don't. Yeah, exactly. They don't think like the horrors of war, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think it would have, I would like to play a game that's described as a tragedy.
Right.
We don't.
Absolutely.
That's not something that we get.
I think you may have. What about Grand Theft Auto 4? I think you could describe that game as a tragedy.
No. Yeah, I don't think so. I
mean, it's not a war game, but.
But I think that because it ends on a success, it is not a tragedy.
I don't think it ends on a success.
Like.
I don't want to spoil the end of the game, but it's like you've killed somebody who matters a lot to you, and like sure you've stopped kind of the bad guy, but you don't have anything. Like you don't have any money or a success or a job or like anything that you came to America for.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
You know, you I guess you could argue like you've kind of got your freedom and resolved kind of these things that you were hung up with in the past, but. Like, where does that really leave you?
I think you're right. It is a tragedy in the sense that Goodfellas is a tragedy.
Right. Right. Exactly.
At the end of Goodfellas, like he's stuck
safe.
Yeah, he's stuck in the witness protection program, and he has to take on this life that's totally opposite what he's ever wanted to do. And yeah, he's alive, but like that's not.
What did that get him?
Yeah, it's not worth living. That's an interesting point. I'd like to see what other games out there have that kind of tragic ending, because. Generally, we would hear about this kind of stuff. Now, we should say that we have not played Modern Warfare 2, neither of us.
No, I kind of not been. I don't know that much about the campaign. I believe it does a similar thing. I mean, I know there's. It gets a little trickier because it sounds like there's a lot of double crossing and triple crossing and quadruple crossing, right. and like you're fighting on different sides, but like your motives are maybe not in line with the people you're fighting with. So.
And I've been avoiding it too. So a lot of people who've been writing on blogs have been writing about the scene or the. What a chapter, No Russians. I have no idea like what that means. Like I have an idea of what it's about in general, but like
we are not qualified to talk about the specifics of that narrative.
So that there's another area of discussion you might choose for your paper, which is how are games or how do video games, war games represent tragedy? you don't have to say like this entire game is tragic, but you can take specific scenes from war games, and you know, talk about, you know, either family tragedy, personal tragedy, other people dying, the general like discussion of whether or not war is right and what you're doing is just. You have to play a lot of games to do that.
Right. And like, is it glorifying war?
Right.
You know, like where, you know, I think that's an interesting question. And I often think that, not that it's not worth asking, and that I'm not saying that video games don't glorify war, but it's something like why is, you know, like Saving Private Ryan instantly like a great representation of war and is like a teaching tool, when maybe something like Call of Duty like wouldn't.
Right. You know, there's something to be said about games that contain factual information. One thing about the Medal of Honor series is that, you know, they tried to convey a lot of what you consider to be documentary information. So, you know, they have notes and video clips and things like that.
And they work to recreate actual battles.
Right. So, you know, there was a video that hit College Humor the other day, which is some dudes took Saving Private Ryan, the invasion of Normandy scene, and then put like a HUD over it and like did fake voice chat. And it was like, you know, like the gunner up in the towers, like shooting down. He's like, yeah, go ahead, hide behind that cross thing. That's going to help you. And there's like little, you know, little name tags over top of everybody, like a multiplayer game.
That's funny.
It was kind of funny. It went on for a little too long, but it
sounds like a College Humor video.
The concept was pretty good. Or maybe in Funny or Die. Maybe in Funny or Die.
Yeah.
But I hope we gave you some stuff to think about, at least. Like, if you have any other specific questions that you want to ask us, like, based on my research, I've done a lot. At this point, I've done a bunch of research related to, like, the serious topic of these type of games. I have played games where you take on the role of an Iraqi soldier.
Oh.
I mean, the problem is that the game sucks.
Okay.
So it's basically unplayable. Like, there's something to be, like, said for it because of that. Mm-hmm. But I think to really tell that kind of story, like, you need to have a well-polished game, or else it just feels...
Of course, yeah, because if you make a game where you play an Iraqi and it exists in a vacuum, like, is it... How relevant is it to, like, any kind of discussion like this?
Right.
So, good question.
Excuse me.
Speaking of good, do we got time for the next question?
Yeah,
or should we move?
We definitely do.
Okay, so... before mentioned, friend of the show, sometimes co-host of the show, Jimmy, he had questions about Tony Hawk Ride, but he was too busy to look up our regular email address, which is, by the way, lowscorepodcast@gmail.com.
I'm glad you can get it right.
Yeah, couldn't be easier. So he writes, this is a couple days ago, he said, apparently Tony Hawk Ride came out yesterday, and he wants to know how we feel about the chances of success for both this and DJ Hero, which we've talked about before. He says they're both the same price at $120, and both include fairly ridiculous peripherals. He's interested in our predictions for the retail commercial viability rather than just personal level of interest, which, especially for Tony Hawk Ride, he correctly suspects is zero. It seems like most people in the game's press have been willing to give DJ Hero a chance. It got generally favorable reviews, while the skepticism of the skateboard controller is a lot more widespread, which is odd. The Wii balance board sold like gangbusters, and the skateboard seems like a more refined version of that. Conceivably, if Tony Hawk Ride does well, it'll be a lot easier for other games to make use that board peripheral, you know, snowboarding, surfing games. And he is a big fan of the idea of getting achievement points for surfing. It'd be like sucking all the purity out of two forms of entertainment at once. The DJ Hero turntable, on the other hand, is only good for simulated DJing unless I'm going to make a Thomas Jefferson game that required you to interact with Lazy Susans or Wheel of Fortune, I guess.
Hey. That's an idea.
That'd be pretty good. I know DJ Hero didn't do too well in the October NPD numbers, and I haven't seen any marketing for Tony Hawk Ride. Apparently Activision is not shipping any review copies to the press. He predicts big price cuts for these games after Christmas, especially since they both have huge boxes to take up valuable store space. Then he writes an addendum a few days later. After watching the Giant Bomb quick look of Tony Hawk Ride, I must modify my question to acknowledge that Tony Hawk Ride is poop from a butt. which, if you have seen that quick look... and their subsequent review where they gave it 1 star out of 5, their lowest review score. It looks pretty terrible. So, yeah, DJ Hero looks kind of fun. Tony Hawk Ride looks terrible. They're both expensive. Are these games going to sell? I mean, initially, DJ Hero did not do great.
No.
And I suspect Tony Hawk Ride will not. So why?
Okay. Well, number one, I think that DJ Hero's audience is not the rock band Guitar Hero audience. That's it. Mm-hmm. That's just a problem with it straight up, is that the songs that it's using do not necessarily appeal to the same crowd. So you can't just say, well, yeah, I like Rock Band, so I'm just going to get other things that are like Rock Band. So relying on that is for sales would be a big problem. The second is, you know, when you made the Rock Band investment, you said, like, yes, I am paying a lot of money for this, but what I'm getting is, A, something that I can play with my friends, because it comes with multiple instruments.
Right. It comes with two controllers and a microphone.
Exactly.
So I guess technically three controllers.
So, like, you know, it's not the singular object that is the turntable from DJ Hero. You can say, and that's an investment as far as, like, not only can I play this by myself, but I can play this with my friends. So I have places that I'm going to do this.
Absolutely.
I also know that in the future, this Rock Band, this box that I bought, is not just a game, but it's a platform for other things.
Right.
And I don't think that people have the same feeling about DJ Hero in that way. Like, we will get more DJ Hero songs, but what are you really going to do to expand this experience? So the cost does not equal
what you're getting out of it.
Yeah, what you're getting out of it.
I think even more succinctly put, the problem that both of these games have, let's talk about the quality of games. These are $120 for one-player games.
Yeah.
As opposed to, you know, Rock Band was $170 when it came out, and now it's basically $100 for a four-player game. And even though you have to invest more to get another guitar, but even if you just got the game on itself, you could find other people, everybody could bring their peripherals on, and you can get your four-player on. These are, I mean, I know DJ Hero has guitar parts for a couple songs, but those are clearly like the bastard part. Like, playing the guitar songs in these, you know, mashups don't make any sense. Like, that does not sound fun at all.
Right.
So because these are ostensibly single player experiences, to pay double the cost for a game is, I think, even for the novelty factor, is a really, really hard proposition. You know, for people to even ask for a holiday.
Now, he does compare it to the Wii Balance Board, which he says sold like fucking gangbusters.
Right.
And that is ostensibly a single-player experience. I would like to know how many people who bought a Wii Balance Board haven't used it in months.
Right. Well, I think there's a lot
more than a couple of weeks.
I don't think the Balance Board is a very good... Well, I actually think it's a good peripheral. I think the game Wii Fit is pretty poor. And I don't think that peripheral works, like, I guess. I mean, it's bad in the sense that there's not a whole lot you can do with it. But I think there's some factors to this. One, it was $90. So you didn't feel like it was not double the cost of a game.
Double the cost of a Wii game?
It was almost double the cost of a Wii game. That's true. I mean, it was clearly much more expensive. I almost feel like... It's not a video game. It would be like people pay a lot of money for fitness programs. People spend hundreds of dollars on treadmills and bikes and stuff that people buy and feel good about and don't use. So I feel like in terms of comparison to those things, it's wildly cheap. And the idea, like, you can that idea that was not fulfilled, that you could buy additional software and expand on it and all this.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like a pretty easy, like, justification. Like I'm gonna better myself, and working out is not necessarily thought of as a group activity. I mean, sure, people go like running together and stuff, but it's like something you do. I almost feel like it's a little bit different in that sense. You know, you're marketing to people who are not looking for a game experience. Like, I hope nobody bought Wii Fit looking for a fun game. I think people thought it might be a fun way to work out or a fun, you know, kind of distraction.
But you think that there are people out there who bought it specifically because it is a Wii thing and a Wii peripheral?
Definitely. I think
without considering, like, this is for me working out, or what am I going to do with this? They're like, oh, this is like, you know, another controller that I'm going to need because I have a Wii.
I don't know if that was justification. I would phrase it more like, they're people who bought it because they like the Wii Sports and they like the novelty of it. And there are people who are like, this is like along the same lines of why I bought it. Here's the next new kind of novelty thing. I don't like video games. Here's a new way to control games with my feet. That sounds fun. I'm already up wiggling this remote around.
Yeah.
You know, so, Yeah, I think so. I think there's a lot of different reasons people bought that, but...
But Tony Hawk Ride. So if this game gets terrible reviews...
Right.
It will sell to people who, A, didn't read any reviews.
Uh-huh.
B, just don't give a shit. And C, just like, they're like, oh, that's sold on name alone to people who are uninformed.
Yeah.
And other than that, this isn't going to sell to anybody.
I don't think it's the idea looked terrible from the start. And, I'm really curious. I really want people to start reviewing this because it seems like the Metacritic numbers, this is going to be the game that calls out the illegitimate press.
Right.
Because if you looked on launch day, there were only three reviews. They were all over 90, like Team Xbox, 360.com, and two others. Then the real reviews started coming out. It was like, obviously, Giant Bomb gave it a 1 out of 5. And you had Game Informer, which gave it like a 55. So both pretty terrible reviews. A 55 might as well be a 1 out of 5, because no game gets below a 50 in right. most publications. It seems really interesting. Not that somebody couldn't legitimately give it like an 80%, but even if you read like the Team Xbox review, it reviews the idea of the game. It does not review like the actual quality. They say like straight up, they're like, the score is about like what they're trying to do, man.
That doesn't help me. I need to buy this.
I was like, I don't give a shit. I was like, well, I didn't make a game, but I think I have an idea that I don't have formulated about an idea of a game.
Four stars.
Four stars. Thanks.
I'm giving you four stars.
Thanks. I mean, it's just crazy. I think it's hard to talk around the fact that like Tony Hawk Ride looks freaking terrible. So they could have charged 60 for this game and it probably would fail. Like 60 with the board because it's bad. If DJ Hero was cheaper, maybe if it was $80.
I agree.
I think you would have seen something a lot different.
People
willing
to take the risk.
When Guitar Hero came out, that was ostensibly a single-player game because the multiplayer wasn't that good. It was $70, and you felt like, if a game's 50, this is $20 with an extra controller, I'll pay a little bit more because I'm getting a controller for myself.
Right.
If Guitar Hero came out and it was $100, double the cost of a PlayStation 2 game, I don't know if anybody would have jumped on board.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that, personally, I'm interested in DJ Hero. And at some point, I would...
Me too.
It would be cool to own that game if it was the right price. So it is a matter of if it is the right price. And I don't understand what they think they are selling and why they think they can get away with it. Is it just based on name alone?
Right.
Do the rights to all those songs cost that much more? Does building the plastic turntable cost that much more? The problem is that the build quality of the turntable just... I didn't really care for it. I didn't care for the weight of it. I think that the fader doesn't have a good sticking point in the middle, so that it was too easy. And that's fine. Like if that's the way that DJing is, well then I can understand that. But you also need to make it fun for a game. Like I need to be able to select the middle selector without having to worry too much.
I will be honest. Having played Rock Band 2 and hearing some of the early reviews for the peripheral, they sound like the Rock Band 1 peripherals. I'm like, I'm wondering if I wait a year and, DJ Hero 2 comes out, I wonder how much better that peripheral is going to be, because it's just like the Rock Band 2 stuff. Like the drums are so much better than the Rock Band 1 drums. It's like just a year later, people were like, oh, we got to make them soft and like we got to make them wireless and we have to make the pedal like really heavy.
Right.
You're like, oh my God, these are so much better. It seems like paying $60 for a controller that it works and is pretty good, but there's some little improvements that can be made. Is harder for me to pull the trigger on, especially when the cost is so high.
Jimmy writes this morning, actually, I'm just reading it now. The best part is that for $120, you could buy an actual skateboard plus a decent game.
Yeah, that's again, I'm talking about Tony Hawk Ride. It seems that that game. Fuck that game.
Yeah, I'm just, you and I love the Tony Hawk series.
Oh my God! Huge. We were talking. It's one of the Tony Hawk 3, I believe. It's one of the 50 games that define the decade.
Yeah, and like, there's so much potential there. And I was thinking about the other games that could possibly use this. So one, like a snowboarding game. All right. Well, that makes a little bit more sense because in a snowboarding game, you don't have to do the fake kick on the floor because you
just
gravity.
Downhill. Yeah. Right. But even like ostensibly, like obviously, it's quite a bit different from skateboarding. How would the move, because you have to simplify and dumb down the actual movements anyway. So how would it operate much different than a video skateboard in terms of like moving your hands over the sensors to do grab tricks and flip tricks and stuff like that?
It wouldn't. And that's,
it wouldn't.
Like, if you played an actual snowboarding game that was not like a exaggeration, it would not be fun.
Right.
Because the fun about snowboarding is like the experience of like balancing and stuff. That's not the fun in the game.
It would be like if they made a realistic like a guitar game.
Right.
With like six strings and stuff. Like, not that playing the guitar isn't fun, but now you're teaching yourself to play guitar. You're not playing a game. Like, you know.
In snowboarding games, characters' feet come detached from the board. That's just, it doesn't happen.
Like, right, no, they're strapped in.
Like, SSX wouldn't be any fun if you were strapped in, and Amped wouldn't, well, does Amped detach from the board? I can't remember.
I don't know if I ever played Amped.
Amped 3 is fun, but I can't remember. But yeah, like, it's the idea that you're doing, like, all these, like, really crazy things. And it's like, when you're watching Tony Hawk, like, what's fun to do in Tony Hawk? Well, it's fun to chain like an insane combo of grinds and, you know, manuals and reverts and vert tricks and stuff and just like grind across an entire level. The button presses that you do that shit, insanely complicated. It takes a long time to learn how to play a Tony Hawk game because you're sliding, you're pressing buttons.
Right, right.
You got combos.
As we've talked about before, I think it's what they miss is like the Tony Hawk games are great because they are crazy and weird, and they don't seem to get that. For years, they've been trying to make the series more realistic, putting in those stupid storylines, you know, about like seeing what it takes to be a kid on the streets growing up to be a pro skater, or now like making it into a board. It's like, no, this is not like fucking make it crazy. Like, Tony Hawk Through Time, put, like, I was skating with fucking dinosaurs, skating on the moon, skate park on the moon.
Yes. You know?
Embrace, like, when you put fucking Kiss characters in there or Wolverine and shit. It's like, yes, that's what I want. Make it goofy.
Right. And in some senses that, you know, they're trying to define themselves in terms of the series Skate, which is a much more realistic.
It's, you know, it's thing is so depressing. They're like, oh, here's a realistic skateboard or more realistic skateboarding game. That's successful. Let's do that. It's like, no, you should be like, that game exists.
Let's
carve out a new market.
And
you know,
you don't even have to invent anything new. You've already invented that genre. Like, just
for fun game. Yeah.
So
I think if they had taken a year off like they did and came out with some killer level designs and no new shit, just like the same Tony Hawk stuff and some great new levels, I think would have sold like gangbusters.
Yeah.
It would have been great.
And this is, you know, this has been also, it's Tony Hawk's pet project. Like, he wanted this game to exist. Like, he's on the design team for this. It's not like they just made a game and strapped his name to it and he got a bunch of cash. Like, this is in part his project, which is a part of the problem. Like, how do you let someone, like, design a game who's not a game designer? What kind of input should they actually get?
That's the part where the game designer needs to sit Tony Hawk down and say, your idea is not fun, and here's why.
Yeah.
Or, like, is not technologically possible now, and here's why.
I mean, I wonder if there's any resentment in Neversoft. Neversoft still does it, right?
I don't know.
Activision. Whatever company in Activision made the new Tony Hawk game, Tony Hawk Ride. You know, I wonder if there's any like discussions like behind the scenes, just like this fucking just not going to work. Like, this, we have to put this out, but what do we do?
They must know it's terrible. I mean, they didn't have any events. They didn't, you know, show anybody.
Developers Robomoto and BuzzMonkey. They did the Wii version. I have no idea who Robomoto is.
I don't know. But yeah, what a tragedy.
So yeah,
well,
never mind.
Should we move on? Should we wrap this thing up with the big feature?
Yeah, wrap it up.
Wrap it up.
Wrap
with
it
the
up
second
for 40
part.
Minutes.
So those of you who listened to Big Episode 32 know that we started a new feature, which will be a 2-part feature, the 50 games that defined the decade. You know, it's the we're coming up on the end of the aughts of the 20-aughts. And it's been a great year, and we're going through the games in rough chronological order that helped define it. We did 28 games last time, the first 5 years of the decade, and we're about to wrap it up with the 22 final games on our list, covering years 2005 through 2009.
I'm going to kick it off with a game designed by our good friend. We know him personally, David Jaffe. We're drinking buddies.
Yep. Everybody's favorite Jaffe.
And it's God of War, of course. Now, the reason that we chose God of War when we already had something like Devil May Cry on the list is that God of War took and I think it's the, as I said last time, it's the epitome of what used to be the beat 'em up genre.
Yep.
Number one, excellently produced.
Like, oh yeah, it looks freaking fantastic.
That game still holds up, and God of War 2 still looks just awesome.
Fantastic. Yeah.
It is a game that's not ashamed to be what it is. Like, it is totally over the top. It is violent. It has nudity. It takes, like, serious matters. It is about, you know, revenge and, I would say, in a sense, tragedy, although it's not a tragic game, but, you know, that kind of Greek tragedy that it's based on. And just totally goes over the top with it and executes it really, really well. And I think that is sort of a flagship title for what is now, you know, PlayStation 3. Like, that is a reason to have a PlayStation 3 is God of War 3. Like, that is just something that's...
Absolutely.
I don't know if it's going to sell the system, but, you know, you're going to get that there, and Sony can brag about having this big title on it.
It's like buying an Xbox knowing that Halo games are going to come out for it. It's the same thing. You're like, this series is reliably fantastic. Like, God of War, yes. I'm going to go down, you know, next on the list in 05, the first Guitar Hero, which we just mentioned. You know, it seems like it's weird to think that game, you know, 4 years ago seems like so short and also so long. I mean, it seems at this point like these games have been around for forever. You know, the Rock Bands and Guitar Heroes and Band Heroes and DJ Heroes and everything else. When Guitar Hero came out, it was such like a weird novelty in the U.S. And I think it was this breakthrough game in a way that like Dance Dance Revolution wasn't. In like goofy peripherals are okay. It was like the first time we all sat down and embraced rhythm games and peripherals. And I think paved the way for a lot of stuff that like has happened on the Wii, the whole music game explosion. I mean, it's weird to think when that game came out, it was like I couldn't get enough of it. I sat there and I played through that game four times, like on all four difficulty levels. Something that, like, I couldn't see myself doing now, just like arbitrarily playing whatever song they want. I'm like, well, now I'm picky. I want to play specific songs that are fun.
Yeah, you know, I remember standing in my bedroom with Jimmy, and we would just trade like back and forth, like one person plays a song,
only that one guitar.
Yeah. And to look back on it, too, as sort of like a historical artifact, to think that game doesn't have, you know, all original licensed music.
It has no original license. It has like 30 songs, maybe 40 songs.
I thought it had a couple songs that were originals.
Nope. The Guitar Hero 1 does not have any original songs. Really? Maybe some of the bonus tracks might, like some of the harmonics tracks and stuff.
That doesn't count.
But no, the main storyline, not a one.
I thought it had just a couple. So, yeah. Nope. And now people are clamoring. They're knocking down the doors, like, put our song in your game. Harmonix came out with the Rock Band Network or whatever the fuck they're calling it so that you can make your own songs and create a marketplace for them. Like, that's huge.
I read a review for Weezer's new album, Ratitude, which I didn't think was that great. But in the review, they said, this is the first album I've ever heard that sounds like it was designed to kick ass in Rock Band. Like, as a music critic, like, thinking about their experience of like what am I going to tell people about this album, like that now is rolling in their head, which is crazy.
That is nuts.
Yeah, so huge.
All right, next up for 2005, a game that I fell in love with, and I think everyone fell in love with, even though we didn't want to admit it, and that was Nintendogs.
Oh yeah.
So here we are. We're for all intents and purposes hardcore gamers. We play the things that are cool. We say fuck games that aren't really games.
Totally.
And then they're like, well, what if we like gave you a puppy and you had a touchscreen and you could like pet it and feed it and then you could take it for walks? And we're like, okay, yeah, sure. How cute is the puppy? Is it real cute? Then, yeah.
Well, I remember at first when I saw this at E3 and they were demonstrating it, you know, Miyamoto came out and touched it. I was like, what? I was like, I don't understand. I don't see what I could do with that. But yeah, then come around, you're like, that dog's pretty cute. Like, that dog's really cute. And you're like, okay, you want to get a frisbee? You want me to rub your belly? Give you a little bath?
And that was the first game like that. Like, so Tamagotchis and stuff had been popular and whatever, like the Digipets.
Yep.
But it was the first game that had the correct control where, you know, you could do this on a computer screen, I guess, but there's something about the way that you hold the stylus as opposed to just, like, pointing a mouse and rubbing on it. Like, you know, you're physically touching the belly
right,
of the
it's very tactile.
And that tactile feeling is what makes it a success. I still think that they need to make a Nintendogs Wii. Like, that would sell really well.
Oh, I think it'd be great. It makes no sense that they don't do that.
No, you're going to miss the fact that you're, like, not touching on the screen, but I think that, like, the movement of your hand and stuff is
going
to be...
And I think if you could have, you know, like, two remotes going at the same time, like, you know, one person's patting the head, one person's patting the belly or something, yeah. Or, like, each person has a treat and you throw them and see which one the dog goes for. I mean, there's a lot of, like, multiple people interactions you could do with that.
And the thing that they did well with the game is they actually put, like, game into it. They put goals into it.
Yeah.
So, you know, not only are you trying to just, like, raise a puppy and have it be happy and stuff, but you are teaching it to do tricks, and you're taking it to shows, and it's, like, running through the course, and you're building up, like, you know, your walking distances and stuff so that eventually you can walk around the entire neighborhood with your dog.
Right. You make your dog like you more so it'll be more responsive, and you can do more tricks and go on longer walks.
And then to do cool stuff, I mean, this it didn't necessarily work that well, but to use the microphone for teaching the dog tricks.
That was,
like,
awesome.
I remember sitting on the bus at UVA, like, riding home and being like, sit.
Sit.
Sit. Sit. Sit. This is really embarrassing.
Yeah, and it makes me sad, too, thinking back. It seems like nobody's thinking about the DS like that anymore.
Nah, now the DS is just like...
It's just like game on one screen, map and inventory on the other.
Yeah. Because they realize that in most cases, like, the stylus, like, it just blocks your hand. Like, you can't see stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Nintendogs.
Bummer. I'm going to go with Luminous for the PSP, which is now on every platform, but really, PSP is the version that you want. We talked last time about WarioWare, you know, a game that kind of redefined a puzzle game, and Luminous comes out, and it's just like, you know, it seems like Tetris and games like that are not a genre where the technology really matters. That it's like, why do you need a bigger screen for Tetris? Like, you just need a little, you know, square to make it happen. Luminous was a game designed on the PSP to take advantage of the big widescreen, beautiful color palette, better speakers, or not really great speakers on there, but better sound processor and stuff. So, and take all that technology into advance when thinking about a puzzle game, while still keeping it simple and intuitive. It's a game that has great music and backgrounds. It's a game that uses the whole screen. And it's a game that has a really wonderful pace. It's a slow-paced puzzle game where kind of the franticness of it really sneaks up on you, even more so than Tetris, which kind of starts out that way until you get into higher levels. But for a long time, you can just kind of leisurely play Luminous, and then all of a sudden you find yourself like, oh wait, oh my God, I've got to get these together. If you haven't played it, it's a real simple game where there's blocks falling down. You've got two colors, and you basically take these 2x2 blocks and need to make 2x2 blocks of the same color on the bottom. And when that happens, this line comes across the screen and wipes them out, and then the blocks fall, and you can try to make chains and stuff. If you've played like Super Puzzle Fighter, it's a similar idea to that. But it was a really special game and a real good, you know, in the same way that Tetris did for the Game Boy, this kind of system seller for the PSP.
People still play Luminous. They talk about their insane high scores.
It's still the best game on the PSP. I mean, it's still the reason to play that system. Where, I mean, the PSP has fine games. I mean, you can play, you know, Final Fantasy VII Crisis Core, or, you know, all these Tactics, or like God of War game. Daxter. These are all great games, but they are not portable games. They don't really matter that they're on a portable handheld. In fact, you say that so many games get part of the PS2.
Yeah, I got to say that there's something about playing Luminous on the PSP, which I haven't done a whole lot of, but I've played the game. And I've also played it on, like, Xbox. There's something about, in the same way that Nintendogs, about having your finger, like, the tactileness, of having your hands wrapped around the screen, that you really feel like you're holding on to something. It's not like I'm doing something, you know, in front of me, and then, like, across the room, like, events are occurring. Like, you really feel like you're a part of that. That's one thing about the PSP form factor I like. It's like being wrapped around the game physically.
Yep.
It's like it's like reading a newspaper. It's like holding something.
Right.
As opposed to, like, scrolling on a mouse.
There's an intimacy of experience when your hands are on it. Right. Even as opposed to, like, reading the news article on the screen.
Yeah.
It's just such a wonderful game and holds up. You know, it's one of those games where you're like, that game is going to be fun forever. I mean, it's literally going to be fun forever.
All right, let's take one of the series that let's take a series that hardcore fans love and make it actually playable by other people. And all we're going to do is move the camera. That's all we're going to do, literally.
There's only one game you could be talking about.
It's got to be Resident Evil 4.
It's got to be Resident Evil Quattro.
I tried, before I even played 4, I played the other games to some extent, either rented them or borrowed them or just tried. I wanted to like this series that people who liked it love them.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
You know, there is no middle ground. Like, either you love it and you can play it, or you couldn't stand it and you put it down.
Yep.
And Resident Evil 4, by moving the camera and making it over the shoulder, fixed what was wrong with the controls, the tank controls of these games.
I mean, fixed is absolutely the word. It is a game that, in my opinion and in yours and I think a lot of people's, it was broken. Like, the weird tank controls, the weird, like, fixed camera, like you said, and abject movements felt like a cheap way to induce scariness by making the game hard to control.
Right.
That's my opinion. And by kind of taking that out and fixing some real problems while maintaining, like, what was so good about the series, or what people, you know, love about it, was the characters and the over-the-top storyline and the monster design and, you know, level design and stuff, et cetera, et cetera.
And here's something so strange about this. This game came out on the GameCube.
It's GameCube. And now, you know, it's been ported to the Wii and the PS2, but it was on the GameCube only for at least a year, maybe more.
Like, that's...
Bonkers. For a game, you know, Resident Evil 5 was like, you know, Xbox 360, PS3 game. You know, Resident Evil 1 was a PS1 game. You know, they think of these as like, you know, Resident Evil 2 and came out on everything, you know, Dreamcast and N64 and I forget what else. But it seems like this was not the place for a big hardcore M-rated gory fucking game.
It's like, yeah, what do you do with your cube? Well, I play Smash Brothers.
Pikmin.
It's
Smash Brothers machine.
This is Smash Brothers machine. It was. It's like a Wii bowling machine. So for them to take the risk and put Resident Evil 4 on there first, because number one, I mean, it could have gone on the Xbox and looks great, but the GameCube looked better than the PS2.
Like, definitely.
In general, it looked better. So that game still looks pretty damn good. It's surprising. Something is wrong with Jay's microphone.
Sorry, I can't get it to tighten up.
Jay is like upside down under.
I'm having a real time here, people. I'm sorry.
I got it.
I'm good.
You good? Great.
All right.
You're not good. You're upside down.
I'm upside down, but that's okay. You want to know what's upside down?
What's upside down?
Nintendo's strategy for online gaming.
Hazaw. What the fuck does Hazaw mean?
You're upside down too with your nonsensical exclamations.
I wanted to say hey now and hey ya, and I said Hazaw. Hey now.
But you know, it seems like the one and probably only time they got it right was Mario Kart DS for the Nintendo DS.
Right. Not an early Nintendo DS game, but now in the duration of the system, it's generally early game. Let's take all the things that people liked about the 3D racing of Mario Kart 64 that kind of sucked.
Right.
Let's throw in some classic tracks, and let's throw in online multiplayer where you can just jump into games with people from anywhere. Like, you just have Wi-Fi connection, and you just jump into games.
It's how every game you want wants to work. It's you know, how you want a shooting game to work. It's how you want a fighting game to work. It's you click the multiplayer button, you click quick match, you get thrown in a match, and you're doing the game.
Right.
You know? That's exactly how it works. No friend code bullshit. I mean, there were friend codes if you want to play with your friends, which, you know, that's one thing. But if you just want to play online with dudes, like, done. It's simple. It's easy. It's elegant. It's perfect.
And they've never done it again.
Not in any game. You know, I kind of in Smash Brothers, but that thing is kind of broken. Not in literally any other game. I mean, now it's to the point where they're making a big deal. New Super Mario Bros. Wii's coming out. All this great multiplayer.
Local.
No online. Local only.
Yeah, and here's the question. It seems that, in general, Nintendo has abandoned multiplayer DS. Is that true? Is my sense of that true?
I think your sense of that is accurate.
You have a game with this Wi-Fi connection built in, and it's very simple. Like, you click on it, and you enter a password, or you connect to a Wi-Fi thing, and you can just go online. Like, it's not a hard task. You don't need to worry about whether people are subscribed to a service. You don't need to log in. You just connect to the internet. Yeah, I don't understand why people don't take advantage of it. Is it that they just think that people aren't going to play multiplayer games because no one's going to buy this stuff?
Like, I guess. Or maybe, you know,
maybe it's as simple as they know how many people are using their multiplayer games, and they're like, you know what, not worth it. Maybe nobody played Mario Kart DS Online.
Well, I don't know.
I never had trouble getting into a match.
I know. I say, if that is the case, then it's because they're making bad games, not because people don't want to play online.
I also think it's because certainly online gaming is at its biggest in the West, and Nintendo is still very, 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 very much... You know, it seems like both Sony certainly seems pretty globally in tune,
mm-hmm.
And Microsoft, I think, to a lesser extent, though they're certainly rooted in the West. But Nintendo still seems the most firmly rooted in the East in terms of their franchises and the kind of games. They're like, listen, if the West likes it, that's great, but if not, whatever. And I think just the fact that online gaming, to my understanding over there, isn't as prolific as it is over here. It isn't just as like assumed. Maybe that's a part of it.
I have an idea for a game.
All right.
What I would like to do is build a game around the guy who does Bender's voice on Futurama.
Yep.
Go. What ideas do you have for me?
Man. All right. So, when I think Futurama, I think hyper-violent alternate future with, bug space aliens.
Okay. Yeah. I feel the same. We're on the same wavelength here.
Does that make sense? Now, Futurama, obviously, is popular with the younger crowd. Also with, kind of the college-age crowd, because it's kind of got some hip humor in there.
Right.
So, let's make a rated M and put it on the Xbox.
Done. I'm down.
Now, here's the question. Who are we going to get to make this game?
Futurama, kind of like cartoony, so we should go for a developer like that. How about, Cliffy B?
Cliffy B sounds good. He's made games exactly like what we're talking about, right?
Yes, he has. That is his forte.
Yeah, man. All I know is that I love Jazz Jackrabbit.
There you go.
So, yes, let's do this.
Let's do this. I don't know what to say about Gears of War besides the fact that it perfected the cover mechanic. It has awesome online multiplayer. It is so awesomely over the top.
Yeah, I mean the cover mechanic is huge. I mean it just seems like now that is like a standard in games. You like assume it's going to be there, and the fact that these characters, usually people are running around real fast and, there's a lot of spry, jumping around. These are big, beefy motherfuckers. They move slow. They seem heavy. Even when you're running, you like crouch down and like sort of run. Great story. Looks fucking amazing.
It does. I bought this game and when I bought my Xbox 360, this is one of the games that sold me. And I hooked it up to our big TV in my mom's living room when I lived back there. And she's got like a gigantic TV. It's like 59 inches or something. It's huge HD TV. Man, like that game just looks awesome.
It was one of those times when the 360 came out, you were like, I don't know, man, my PlayStation 2 looks pretty good. And like God of War, 2 was coming out and Final Fantasy 12. And you're like, these games look fucking fantastic. And you looked at those early Xbox 360 games like King Kong and like Cameo. And you were like, I don't know about this system, man. This doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And so it was a year later when Gears of War started coming out and, other games. But you were like, oh, I'm sorry. I get it. These really are special.
It's interesting to note that the person that was one of the writers on Gears of War also was one of the writers on BioShock, the head writer on BioShock.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Susan O'Connor.
So, speaking of the Xbox, all that stuff that we were just talking about graphics looking great?
Yes.
Fuck it.
What?
Fuck it. I don't care. I don't give a shit.
Okay.
I don't give a goddamn hell about it.
What?
I'm gonna make a game where the you remember vector graphics?
Yeah, I remember like the Vectrex and like Vectrex. Asteroids and stuff.
Asteroids.
Okay.
The old like Star Wars arcade game, stuff like that.
Not Sinistar. Tempest.
Tempest, probably Tempest. The most famous. I'm gonna take that. I mean, I don't want to make a vector game per se,
right.
But that aesthetic, that feel, those like three colors.
Okay.
I'm gonna put it into a modern game.
You're insane.
I am insane. You also know what? You know how as we've been moving on, every controller, more and more buttons, a lot of choices.
Yes. Oh, you should use every button.
No buttons. Fuck buttons.
What?
No buttons. Fuck them.
What are you going to do? How are you going to have something without buttons?
You know, we got those joysticks.
Yeah, we got two of them.
Two of them. All right. One, you know how you use one of them for moving around and one of them for looking around?
Like, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay. That one for looking around, that one's for shooting.
Whoa. So this is like Robotron.
It's like Robotron. It's like Smash TV. Except just triangles and squares and shit.
This is never going to work. You're never going to get away selling this game for 50, 60 bucks.
Yeah, I'm not going to charge that much. I'm gonna charge it for a discounted price.
What, like 40?
Like five.
$5?
$5.
You're insane.
And we're not even going to press a disc. Just download only.
I mean,
we're going to assume you have the internet. If you don't have the internet, fuck you. You're done. This is Geometry Wars Retro Evolved.
Whoa, big surprise.
Again, like everything we're talking about now is taken for granted. I mean, like downloadable games have come so far in the 3 years where like big expansive games have come out but nobody seems to have matched like the simplicity of it. You know, we talked about the GBA and the DSP and nice platforms are kind of retro, more simple type games, but those still didn't have a market for really cheap games, $5 and $10 nuggets of games. You know, this came out on what was then called the Xbox Live Arcade, which a name that's kind of, it's still around, but I don't think of it so much as an arcade games. But back in 2006, like that was the point. It was like, let's reproduce the arcade where you came in and you played a game for 3 to 5 minutes and you had a lot of fun and it was a low cost of entry, just a quarter. What if you could pay $5 and get a simple experience that was rewarding again and again and again and again?
Yeah.
And Geometry Wars really feels like that. It feels like a Galaga. It feels like a Pac-Man of a game that you play and you instantly want to master it. Like it seems very difficult to master, but not impossible. It really achieves that feeling.
And I think it's kind of sad that this doesn't really exist in this format anymore. Yes, it's awesome that we get games like Shadow Complex, which are, you know, they're short, but they're really involved. I think that in part we have to blame the iPhone.
Yeah.
Because, like, why, you know, if you are a small developer and you have, like, just, like, a simple idea for a game, well, why bother going through, like, the hubbub of Microsoft and learning to program that when you can just use Objective-C, throw it on the iTunes Store for a buck and just hope that everyone buys it for a dollar.
Yeah, it seemed like we were saying, the Xbox Marketplace has changed. The default price has gone up to more $10, $15 games. And there's still a lot of good games coming out on the system, but the time where people could put out a $5 game like this that was really simple, really cheap, you feel like you're getting a lot of money's worth, you know, it doesn't exist anymore. It's still a really special game.
All right. I don't know what I would like to do. Would I like...
You got to pick. You got two games you can pick from.
See, I didn't play either of these games, so I can't. Since I didn't play... One was more involved not playing the other, so that would be Brain Age.
Okay.
Instead of doing shtick around it, I will just say that that is like the Nintendogs type thing, where Nintendo said that our system doesn't have to be about the typical games that you're used to. Like, even on the GameCube, you don't see this kind of stuff. The Game Boy Advance, you didn't see this kind of stuff, where it was activities that weren't games. So, Brain Age. Well, we're going to use the stylus as a writing utensil. And as like a mouse utensil and pointing and stuff, and you're going to be able to do math problems quickly and look at shapes, and we're going to give you this metric so that as you're playing the game, you can see how fast your reaction times and how your brain has been trained over time so that you keep coming back to this thing. We're going to sell it with this goofy Japanese guy's head on it that looks like Andross from Star Fox.
Yes, he does.
And it's going to sell really well, amazingly.
This again, and that's a good point. It's like in a post Katamari world, in a post Guitar Hero world, it's like, let's just embrace the goofy Japanese-ness. And maybe it's not all that goofy anymore. You know, this idea of a professor teaching you games, like putting puzzle games in a new context.
Right.
And it's like, hey, just in case you don't feel like training your brain, we fucking put Sudoku on it.
Yeah, you can play Sudoku if you want. You can
play Sudoku, like, whatever it costs. That's fine.
I'll buy it. Yeah, again, everything you said, just a great game. Totally another in the many games on this list that show Nintendo's new philosophy, where in a lot, kind of the early part of the decade, Nintendo was a company trying to figure out what it was. And with games like Brain Age, with games like Nintendogs, it seemed pretty comfortable figuring out what it was. You know, this game where we are going to make quality products for all ages audiences. The other game you didn't want to talk about was The Elder Scrolls IV Oblivion for the 360 and the PC. But interestingly enough, you know, coming off of a game like Knights of the Old Republic, it's like this is a Xbox 360 game. Like Elder Scrolls III Morrowind came out on the Xbox and the PC. That was a PC game.
Yeah.
This was an Xbox 360 game. This was a game that opened up these kind of games to people who didn't want to invest in high-end PCs, who didn't want to, weren't exposed to them on, you know, the Xbox or the PlayStation 2, could get into these big fantasy worlds, take advantage of the new hardware, the expansiveness, these good control schemes. A year after the Xbox launch, when this game came out, there wasn't a whole lot going on. And to have a game that was so big and rich and expansive, you know, it made that console really thrive, I think, while it waited for another good holiday season of games to come out. I think it was really important.
I remember the discussion you and I had when I said, should I buy Elder Scrolls Oblivion?
Right.
And you said no.
No.
You said no, you won't like that game. No. And I've never bought it since because I know I won't like that game.
I put a little time. It's not that great.
Fallout 3, that's way
fun. Fallout 3 is fantastic. And you know, to be fair, I only played it after Fallout 3 when a lot of fixes have been made. And Fallout 3 still has mad problems, and Oblivion has mad problems. Kevin, but as a piece of its time, it's so good.
Kevin was playing Oblivion for a little bit, I think.
Yeah.
Also, we should note, this was the first game to have the worst type of DLC, which was $2 for armor for your horse.
I forgot. Absolutely. So in an age where people were still trying to figure out this whole DLC thing before, you know, it was like, yeah, $10 for a map pack. You know, people were like, okay, little teeny add-ons, microtransactions, horse armor, $2.
$2. That's
it. Something that was so infamous that, you know, Microsoft on the 360, they will occasionally do deals. There's a deal of the week and stuff like that. And I believe it was on April Fool's Day, they in fact increased the price of the horse armor. I believe it went up to $4.
Yes, they did.
Just this year, which is, you know, so funny. Even they can laugh themselves being like, this is a fucking ripoff.
Yeah.
We're sorry. You know, it certainly has made a lasting impression. And hopefully people have learned their lesson as they try to find more fair prices for DLC.
All right, our next game is defined by one of the coolest game environments and worlds of all time, and that would be BioShock. There's no use saying, well, I'm going to build a city underwater. Well, Jay, what do you... None of that. We're just going to say, like, as far as a game in a medium that does not do storytelling that well, BioShock tells a really cool story. And it's told in the environment. It is told in the world of Rapture. You know, the voiceovers and the small interactions that you have with people, you know, they tell some of the story, and like, you know, your discussions with Andrew Ryan and all that, like that's part of the story. But the real story is this world that has just fallen to bits. And the psychos that live in it and reside in it, and the big daddies who, you know, lumber about, and the little sisters who are just trying to suck life force out of people. You know, a game like the gameplay, like you could say, yeah, it's fine. Like this is kind of like a first person-y shooter thing. And like, it's all right. Like you can shoot bees from your hand if you want, cause you got a magic hand.
That's more than all right. That's excellent. My girlfriend, even though it's terrible, it like doesn't work very well, but it's just fun.
My girlfriend refers to this game as the game with the hand. Cause that's all she remembers is seeing like the curved hand, as you like hold out in front of you. Yeah, she goes, oh, yep. Yeah, the one with the hand? I'm like, yeah, that's BioShock.
Does she think BioShock 2 you're going to have two hands?
Maybe.
They're glowy.
It's a game about
hugging. She's like, how would the third one work? Would you
put a like, foot. Flip. No. You develop a third arm.
Oh, my God. What or kind of crazy world is this?
A second hand on the same arm. That'd be even more.
That would be crazy.
But yeah, BioShock is just such a good game. And to say that, you know, as far as like storytelling and the overall presentation of a game is concerned. Like, BioShock's awesome.
I don't know what else to say about this game. There's not a lot of games that I feel like this about where it's just like, you need to go play BioShock.
Yeah.
Like, right, I almost don't want to say any more than that besides, like, yes, narrative and games.
Then talk about the next game.
I'll talk about a game we've already talked about a little this podcast. That'll be Call of Duty 4 Modern Warfare. I won't go as in-depth as the single-player stuff, which you kind of mentioned, but a few things I want to say. One, this is the game that took Call of Duty and made it into a real franchise. Like, it's funny that the subsequent game, World at War, which went back to the roots into World War II, sold so well because of this game. You know, I feel like Call of Duty 1, 2, and 3 were certainly big games. Call of Duty 1, only a PC game, and 2 and 3 kind of fledgling on different consoles and stuff like that, but... this is the game that I think introduced the world to realistic shooting, you know, in a world where we like our GoldenEyes and our Halos and our Gears of Wars. It's like, nah, here's like realistic, shooting simulation, even if the story's a little over the top and stuff like that. But it's a different style. It feels distinctly different from a game like that. Just in terms of like the way the guns recoil and the way guns reload. And it certainly didn't invent this type of game whatsoever. I mean, Medal of Honor and the previous three Call of Duties have been around for a long time. But it's important because the setting and what really the super robust multiplayer introduced to people, you know, where multiplayer had been very well executed on consoles in the past. By introducing a leveling up system and these perks where you can bring in extra stuff into your game and having different classes and stuff and borrowing little bits and pieces from games like Team Fortress and, of course, Halo and stuff like that and building this new package around it. It was like, this is how we're doing multiplayer from now on.
Yeah.
Huge impact, just tremendous impact. That cannot be understated. And you know, here we are talking. I mean, they almost feel like, you know, people know about Modern Warfare 2, you know, the legacy of this game 2 years later. It's people freaking love themselves some COD 4. And, to make a franchise now that is like as big as your Halos is difficult to pull off. And this game did it.
Next game on our list. I think it could be argued whether or not it deserves to be on this list, but I think that it does have a place here, and that's Peggle.
Oh, yeah. Peggle belongs on this list.
Peggle, and here's why Peggle belongs on this list. Because in a casual, quote, casual gaming world, in which our games are usually a tile matching and jewel matching and swapping and stuff, and it's about that old Tetris Dr. Mario brick block feel, we're gonna make a game that is fun to play, because it's satisfying to watch the pegs or the ball bounce around and, you know, hit the pegs and stuff. But for this game to be so successful as something that is basically just random, like, you know, you can play this game with a little bit of skill and you can make decisions about, say, like which perks or not perks, but like the power ups you're gonna use and how those are gonna affect your gameplay and stuff. Like, for the most part, this game is just like a crapshoot. And for it to still be so fun, to feel like, even if like I can't have like a precise control over what this ball is doing, that I'm still involved somehow,
right?
Because of the fun nature, like the tactile feel of it bouncing around. That's pretty awesome.
It's pretty awesome. Not only is it a fun game, you know, earlier on this list we had Bejeweled, kind of the start of like, you know, a PopCap game or a downloadable game on the PC, these little casual markets working. Not only, you know, Peggle was the game that broke out from that. That wasn't just like, we'll stick it on the Palm Pilot. Mm-hmm. Peggle is like, nah, son, we're going to be legit releases on the DS and the Xbox and the PlayStation and the PSP and the iPhone.
Half-Life 2 themed.
Half-Life 2 themed Peggle. You know, it broke out. It's everywhere. You know, it's like, now we're just not making casual games that are like little time wasters. We're making legit, you know, fun puzzle games that are going to blow up.
I own 3 copies of Peggle. I own it for the PC.
Right.
I own it for my iPhone. And I even bought the iPod version when they used to make games for the iPod.
Dude.
Before the little touchscreen things. So yeah, I have three very different versions of Peggle. It's everywhere.
And I forgot they put it on the iPod. It kind of worked on the iPod.
It did, because what is your control? Move the thing left and right. You got a big thing, circle that moves it left and right.
Yeah, man. We've talked about Portal on this podcast before, quite a bit.
Yes, we have. We've called it, I think, the greatest game of all time.
So we did, and so no surprise it would be on our 50 games that defined the decade. You know, as we said in our discussion, has there ever been a game since the first-person shooter was invented where people were like, why do we got to shoot shit out of this perspective? Like, why can't we use this control in a non-violent way, like make it into a puzzle game?
Mm-hmm.
That in and of itself is so crazy. To have a game in this day and age that is such a short, tight, perfect experience that kind of breaks all these genre conventions, it's rare playing as many games as somebody like we do where you feel like something is brand fucking new. And when you played Portal, you finish that game, you're like, I immediately want to play that game again. Like, what the hell is going on? This is bananas.
Because both BioShock and Portal came out right around the same time, like the Orange Box and BioShock.
Yes.
And BioShock was like, oh man, this is really cool. Like, this takes conventions that I like, and like, you know, so I added this like layer of perfection on top of them. And then I played Portal, and I was just like, as far as like a new game is concerned, this blows BioShock out of the water because it's doing something entirely different.
Entirely different. And, you know, not only was it doing something entirely different of itself, as we were talking about, this game was part of the Orange Box, you know, that came out alongside Half-Life 2 Episode 2 and Team Fortress 2. Games that in and of itself all could have charged, you know, big money, 20 or 30 bucks each. But Valve decided to pack them together and give away Half-Life 2 Episode 1 and the original Half-Life
2
for 50 bucks, 60 on console, but 50 bucks on the PC. It was a value that like people like couldn't help but be like, that doesn't seem right. That seems like so crazy.
And part of it was a significant portion of the people who had it already had Half-Life 2 and at least Episode 1.
Of course.
So they're like, well, we're giving stuff away that people have for free so that they can give it to their friends so that they will buy our thing. And perpetuate the cycle. So, you know, that's the already sunk cost of those two games. But for them just to say, you know what, let's just do it. Let's just throw it all together. And, you know, Half-Life 2 hadn't come out on the Xbox. So your console people hadn't played this before. So it was only PC people before.
What I think was so sorrowful about it was, I think it's a win-win. Because in and of itself, if you gave a shit about Half-Life 2, Episode 2, Portal, and Team Fortress is totally worth $50 put together.
Absolutely.
And if you had heard, you're like, I've heard about that Half-Life 2, but I don't know, it's a little expensive, I don't want to try it. Like, it's like, if you want to buy that, we're going to give you all this other extra shit. You're like, oh my gosh, like, of course. Like, it's a good value proposition for people who hadn't pulled the trigger on the games before. So it's a win-win. So, hugely influential in a lot of different ways. And it feels good, you know, we were just talking about DJ Hero and Tony Hawk Ride and kind of Activision in general, like, wanting to rip us off and wanting to just, you know, just putting stuff in the market to see if they can get away with charging something for an amount of money.
Right.
And to have somebody look the opposite way and then, you know, try to increase numbers by making it a value, I think is cool and unique.
Our next game has to be one of the most significant games of the decade on this list. Like, if we had to pare this down to 10, this definitely would be on it. And it is a game that sold something in a way that hadn't been done since Tetris sold the Game Boy, mm-hmm. where you would have people who bought a Game Boy specifically for Tetris, and that's all they would ever buy in their life.
And feel like they got their money's worth.
Right, and the same thing happened with Wii Sports. There are a lot of people who, I would say that if they don't only own Wii Sports, it is the only game that they really play.
Yeah.
For a long time for me, like my Wii was a Wii bowling machine. It was a $250 Wii bowling machine.
Right, and you're like, you know what? I'm okay with that. If I got a bunch of people over, hey man, that's fun as hell.
And we can say, you know, a lot about this in relation to the Wii, but I think just to talk about the game itself, to one, make it simple. We'll only pack in 5 games.
Right.
Two, we'll make it extremely multiplayer, but we'll also add a single player level to it where you are watching yourself in the same way as Brain Age. Like, you were improving your scores over time, and you can see, you know, your points go up in any individual activity in the game, so that it keeps you coming back to that beyond the fact that it's just fun.
And you know, it's been 3 years since the Wii came out, and to think those controls were so wacky then, obviously everybody remembers. But whenever a new peripheral comes out, it seems like they kind of live and die by their proof of concept. And I don't know if a peripheral has ever had a better, like, proof of concept than Wii Sports, where it was like these five games where that motion control worked great.
Yep.
You know, like, inarguably, like, here's what you can do, people. And you know, there's a lot of discussion on whether the Wii has lived up to that potential. But it still arguably remains the best example of that platform's hardware.
Yeah.
You know, that control scheme. Yeah, what a good game. So, you know, we talked about Guitar Hero, and you can't talk about that without talking about Rock Band, the game that came out 2 years later. The logical extension of that, which transformed that good game into a multiplayer game.
That's amazing. It only took 2 years.
It took 2 years to figure out, by taking that game, that excellent core mechanic, adding another guitar, building a drum peripheral into it, which was, you know, crazy to begin with, taking their successful, you know, karaoke game and sticking that into it, making it basically three games in one for a single player experience, and making it this fun party game experience was fucking brilliant. By building in, you know, all real licensed music, people can listen to their favorite songs. By building a robust downloadable stuff, so people can continue to build on what they've bought by making, instead of just having on the disc, you know, kind of songs that everybody likes, but making it a little more nuanced. Like, hey, if you're a really big fan of this band, you know, like, it may not make sense in a kind of an all ages or all, you know, let's please everybody type of disc. Let's make specific. Just how much bigger they were thinking 2 years later. And by instantly making that idea of Guitar Hero obsolete, you know, what the original Guitar Hero was obsolete, is crazy. And it feels just as fresh and relevant today as it did then. You know, the novelty hasn't worn off because it's such a good, fun, challenging game.
Yeah.
You know, and just that it's if you suck at Rock Band, it's really fun. And if you're great at Rock Band, it's really fun, because it's a challenging puzzle game if you're great at it, and it's a fun party, you know, goofball karaoke machine if you're not.
Yeah. And that's why I bought it. I am no good at those kinds of rhythm games. I'm no good at Guitar Hero, and I'm no good at Rock Band in general. But I love the music. I love just the feeling of playing it. It's to appeal to me. Like, whereas I was like, well, you know, Guitar Hero was like a little much for me. I didn't buy Guitar Hero 2. I'm not really interested in more Guitar Heroes. And for me to say, you know what? Yeah, I'm going to spend $170 on all these peripherals. Like, I'm the exact part of the market that they wanted to capture.
Absolutely. And I just, you know, they just knocked out of the park with a great attitude, and love that game. Shock. I like Rockman.
A game with an old attitude would be Mega Man 9, which came out on the Wii Virtual Console and the Xbox Live Arcade.
And the PS3.
Did it really?
Oh, yeah. Came out on all three.
Oh, I didn't know it came out on the PS3.
Yep.
Well, then that's good. But yeah, like, in a world where...
In a world.
Where we're making updates to old games by making, like, a Pac-Man Championship Edition, where you put a new skin on the original thing, and you can add some other stuff to it. Or even just like releasing arcade games like Robotron, to build an entire game the size of a Mega Man game that looks, feels, and plays exactly like it should have been on the Nintendo many years ago is quite an accomplishment. For them to be willing to take a risk on it and just say, ow, fucker, god damn it, my dog just bit me.
No, been there, man.
Ow.
While he was being a little brat earlier.
For them to say, you know what, like, we're just going to take a risk on this, and we're gonna make it exactly as it should have been, like, if we had released it back in the day. And we're not going to make any excuses. Like, this game is going to be punishingly hard.
Right. Be like, no, like, we're not making an update. Like, we're making an old game. We are making a Nintendo game. It's going to have sprite flicker. It's going to be fucking unfairly hard, and you're going to like it.
They made a successful old game in an era when so much of what appeals to us in old games just does not hold up.
No, I mean, it's a game like Mega Man 2 and 3 are fun because you know the levels. Like Mega Man 9 is so hard. I mean, it's designed for things to surprise you and make – I mean, those games are impossible to beat the first time through, I think. I mean, they're designed for pattern memorization and to know like exactly at which step something's going to jump out from the top of the screen at you.
Yeah.
You know, and know exactly where to jump to make it over the big pit. You know, speaking of downloadable games, we got to talk Braid, a game that we've talked
– We're in 2008 now.
We're in 2008, we should mention. Yeah, we've jumped ahead. Braid, we've talked ad nauseum on this game on this podcast. One of our earliest podcasts, we spend like an hour talking about the ins and outs of this game. To you know, we had Retro Evolved, which proved that downloadable games were big, and we, you know, Braid is one of the games that has helped kind of transform into what it was today. A $15 game that's big, that is both nostalgic looking and carving out you know, new mechanics at the same time. It's infinite time rewinding potion.
A game that couldn't be made anywhere else because of that.
Because of that. Because, you know, it was made by basically one guy. I mean, I think there was another guy doing the music.
Yeah.
I mean, but just this passion project for 3 years. I don't know where yet. I mean, again, it needs to be on that high def screen. It needs to gosh, it's so hard to talk without getting into specifics. And I would point people back to it's either episode 3 or 4, I think, where we talk so much about Braid.
A very Braidy podcast. A
very Braidy podcast. To know the ins and outs of that game. But, you know, it's one of those games that gets labeled as like an art game, like whatever the fuck that means, that like doesn't feel like pretentious, that feels like yes, like it kind of asks big questions without sacrificing being like really fun. And as I mean, it has meta commentary on the medium and past games, and again, it was also like a fucking great puzzle game. Like it's really fun and it's hard and challenging. And God, Braid, love it.
So this is the third in a trilogy of games by Nintendo that take on the, well, we don't really have to be like a standard video game type game. So we had Nintendogs, which is an activity, and we had Brain Age, which is an activity. And the last one would be Wii Fit, which is an activity. It sold, as we discussed earlier, like gangbusters.
Yeah.
You know, we talked about this in Jimmy's question, so we don't need to go into all that detail further. But, you know, this is the type of game that people who bought their Wii, like they bought Wii Sports, and then they bought Wii Fit. And
yeah.
People that you never thought would ever go out and buy a peripheral went out and bought a peripheral. And Carrie, you spent a lot of time trying to find it for your wife, right?
I there was a time where I was trying to get two of them at the same time, where I was waiting at Circuit City to get one for her and for her brother and sister-in-law, you know, who I was tasked with getting it for Christmas. And I was like standing outside and stuff, and you had to wait. And I had to go twice because they would only sell me one at a time, one per customer, you know, back in the summer of 08. It was crazy.
The unavailability of the Wii Fit at the time, I didn't understand it because I didn't see why anyone wanted it. But yeah, that's, I mean, in the same way that the Wii was rare, this game was also rare.
It was very rare. we haven't talked a lot about the PlayStation 3. On this podcast as a series. Bobby is screaming in pain and my dog tosses socks. And
so we gave my dog socks as a toy. Like, we take a tube sock and we, you know, tie a knot in the middle, and then she gets to chew on it and it's yummy. Well, now she thinks that all socks, even the ones you are wearing, are also toys.
Oh, that's a disaster.
So she will just come up and start biting my feet.
But we're not talking about socks.
This isn't a sock podcast.
We're talking about Sackboy.
Ah.
Little Big Planet. You know, PlayStation 3.
Clever.
Thanks. As we've discussed, I think a little bit of a disappointment, a little rocky start getting games out, and even the games that have been really exceptional on have been derivative, you know, games like Metal Gear Solid 4 or Uncharted 2. But Little Big Planet really aimed to do something new. I mean, it was a game that, from the outset, like, was based on user-created content. You know, I mean, obviously there had been games like StarCraft before that relied on user-created maps and multiplayer and stuff like that. But Little Big Planet kind of came out of the gate where it was like, yeah, there's stuff on the disc and stuff, but this is all about, like, you building platforming levels and downloading other people's levels. Like, that was the whole game. I mean, it's a totally unique concept where, like, the level creator, like, was the game.
Right.
And I just think that that's absolutely fascinating. You know, has the game lived up to its promise? Well, you know, kind of yes and no, I guess. Certainly there have been really clever levels that have been explored, you know, especially when that game came out. And there is a lot of unit-generated content. But there's problems about, you know, navigating, trying to find different levels. And
there were issues with copyrighted levels. And, you know, people's first inclination is to go out and make Super Mario Brothers 1-1. Like, that's...
Which they just, you know, take down again and again, and people want to put licensed music and stuff in there. And you know, there's just all kinds of ugly, sad problems that kind of that stuff comes up with.
And it's not, it's not the game's fault.
It's not like Sony's mean for taking down levels with copyrighted music. It's like, yeah, you really can't do that. It's a bummer that you can't do that.
Right.
But that's, I mean, that's the reality. And it's like, dude, and, you know, you can't really blame them either for not wanting, like, Mario stuff in their games. Well. But, you know, I don't know. I think there's a lot that has, but at its core, I think it's a really good game and a really interesting game. And, you know, it's coming out on the PSP. I think it just came out. I haven't heard a lot about it, but I'm interested to see how it works on that platform too. It might even work better. You know, a game that worked with these little small levels. So that's Little Big Planet.
Barreling into the last year of our decade, we only have two games here.
Two more games. You pick a game. Which of these games you want to talk about?
You know what? Why don't you go first?
Okay.
Talk about the one you really like.
Well, I don't think we would be just on our list. You know, it's always hard when you're in the end of the decade, because a lot of these other games on the list we've had time to reflect on. You know, a game like Metroid Prime, we're like, yeah, that held up and that really influenced stuff. Or you know, Grand Theft Auto San Andreas or World of Warcraft. You like, you can confidently say, like, yes, these are big important games. But games in 09, it's a little tougher to identify. Maybe that's why we only have two games on this list. But one game I really wanted to include was Street Fighter IV, a game that came out in February here in the States, and it was out in arcades the previous year in Japan. Fighting games, a genre long thought dormant. You know, arguably not since Soul Calibur on the Dreamcast has there been a fighting game that I think at least symbolically was as important as Street Fighter II or as Street Fighter IV. You know, it's kind of a resurgence we had started to see with Xbox Live Arcade and the Sony PlayStation Store, you know, remakes of Mortal Kombat 2 and Street Fighter, and the Street Fighter 2 HD remix, that you know, big, really well-crafted update. But Street Fighter 4 was, you know, after 15, 20 years of them making, you know, weird Street Fighter 3 and their Neo stuff and decent fighting games and, you know, franchises like Tekken and Soul Calibur kind of trudging along and putting out yearly releases and stuff, but putting out a game like Street Fighter IV that paid homage to, you know, I think inarguably the biggest fighting game of all time, Street Fighter II, bringing back all those characters and those levels and that feel, and adding in a bunch of new characters and making this big robust fighting game and taking advantage of the new norm of online fighting games or of online gaming in general. You know, it was like, this is the time to put the time and effort into making a real great, accessible fighting game like this.
Accessible.
Well.
Yeah, in general, yes. Because, here's the thing, the difference between this and arguably Capcom's other biggest smash hit, Marvel vs. Capcom.
Sure.
Is that this game is very manageable, and because it is manageable in the number of characters, they spent so much time balancing it.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, this game is insanely well-balanced. Even as someone who doesn't recognize the ins and outs of the fighting game genre, I realize like how much perfection has to go into this to make it playable, to make it fun, and to make it something that, you know, the most hardcore fighting gamers are going to appreciate.
Right. So, I just think it's important. You know, people are wondering, you know, is this game doomed to live in, or this genre kind of doomed to live in the shadows? You know, kind of that once was the staple of American arcades and Japanese arcades and home consoles too, with, you know, Mortal Kombat and Street Fighter 2 were so big on the SNES. It's nice to see a game like this come out, and I think, you know, fighting games are back and they're here to stay. And are they ever going to be like first person shooters? No, but I think people are going to pay attention to them.
First person fighting games. Let's do it.
First person fighting games. Let's do it. Yes, done. Yeah. I think it's a big game. So why don't you cap us off? Why don't you end it?
You know, and it sucks to end it on this note because we've discussed so many awesome games that have been influential and important to us. But we would not be doing the video game industry in general a service, or we would be doing them a disservice if we didn't acknowledge the popularity of Facebook games. So we chose Farmville as the, I guess, the representative of this, because there are no other. I mean, the Facebook games are all over the place. Like, there are Mafia Wars, and you play stuff like that. And now there's, like, Fishville, and I think they're making a Petville, the Zynga Games people.
Right.
So is Farmville a good game? Like, no, not really. But you can't.
No, it's not terrible. I mean, it certainly doesn't belong on a list of games like BioShock and Portal.
Right.
It's certainly a super simple game. And anybody who's played video games is like, well, yeah, there's like, I've played Sim Farm, and it's really boiled down. But is it like terrible in the sense that like Tony Hawk Ride is terrible?
No.
It
knows what it means to be a video game, and it could get people to compulsively play in the way that a World of Warcraft can get people to compulsively play, where I always need to better myself, where I always need to be doing something every day because I have a limited amount of time, a limited amount of things that I can do, so I need to keep logging in. And it also says a whole lot about what it means to play this kind of game socially. You play these games by connecting with your friends and by posting these announcements on your wall that says, like, I earned this many cows today, or I bought, like, this stuff today. And then other people say, what, you did what? Like, maybe I should check this out. And it's also extremely dirty in a lot of ways, because the amount of stuff that you can do in a day is based on, I don't remember what the exact counter is, but the idea is that you have a limited amount of stuff in the day, or you can pay us a little more, and you can get more moves, more turns, or...
Yeah. You can recruit a friend.
Or, hey, you know what? You can go, like, check out our sponsors.
Right.
And there has been a big, big hubbub and hullabaloo about what these sponsors are actually doing with the information, and people getting their credit card charged for things that they didn't think they were signing up for, and it just being really, really dirty. But
right. But, you know, like we said, you know, there's both the game itself, and there's, you know, more interestingly, this marketing aspect of this new – I mean, it's a new platform. I mean, obviously it's on a PC. PC's the oldest platform, but embedded into social networks, this is a new idea that people are looking to explore, and they're not going to go away. And Farmville is not going to be the game that hits. But as you know, I like ending on it because it's like going into the next decade and even the next year. Like this is going to start to become a more legitimate place for games, legitimate like the PlayStation 3 or something. No. But legitimate, like the iPhone, certainly. Mm-hmm. You know, I think certainly that we're gonna start to see, you know, people putting more and more time and figuring it out. You know, like early downloadable games, people don't know how to monetize this in a non douchey way, like in a way that's fair to the people making the games and the consumers. And I think that's going to be figured out, or some kind of acceptable balance is going to be struck, and we'll see. I think we're only going to see these types of games grow.
I want to talk about like a really like awesome game right now, just to make up for the fact that we ended on Farmville.
Dude, Borderlands is really fun.
Borderlands is way fun. I'm gonna shoot some dudes after we finish recording this podcast.
That sounds pretty good.
But that's gonna do it for the top 50 games, or the 50 games that define the decade. We would like you to write in if there is something that we missed. We think we covered it. Is there something that belonged on there that we didn't say? Is there something that we said that did not belong on there? Let us know. That's lowscorepodcast@gmail.com. We'll also be posting this list in its entirety at the end of the week, so that everyone doesn't have to listen to the podcast to figure out what the list is, so that you can talk about it. But you should listen to it.
Or even if you listen to it and you didn't want to take down notes on all 50, you can go and reference it.
But hopefully people will see this list and say, I would like to know what they have to say about these games, and I will share this with my friends, which you should do.
You should tell everybody.
And we want you to also write in with your five characters that you would like to hang out with for a day. And that's the list. And we will post all this stuff online so that you have a central repository for your information. Lowscorepodcast.blogspot.com.
Yes.
You can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/BOKISTA.
I'm at jford, twitter.com/jford.
And we will catch you next time.
Bye, everybody.